eyes the way Nynaeve had. He jerked away, prickling. The two women were handling him as if he were a child. "I said it isn't anything."
There was no foretelling this.
Moraine spoke as if to herself. Her eyes seemed to look at something beyond him.
Something ordained to be woven, or a change in the pattern. If a change, by what hand? The wheel weaves as the wheel wills. It must be that.
Do you know what it is? Nynaeve asked reluctantly, then hesitated. Can you do something for him? Your healing?
The request for aid, the admission that she could do nothing, came out of her as if dragged. Perrin glared at both the women. If you're going to talk about me, talk to me. I'm sitting right here.
Neither looked at him.
Healing?
Moraine smiled.
Healing can do nothing about this. It is not an illness, and it will not...
She hesitated briefly. She did glance at Perrin, then a quick look that regretted many things. The look did not include him, though, and he muttered sourly as she turned back to Nynaeve.
I was going to say it will not harm him, but who can say what the end will be? At least I can say it will not harm him directly.
Nynaeve stood, dusting off her knees, and confronted the Aes Sedai eye to eye.
That's not good enough. If there's something wrong with...
What is, is. What is woven already is past changing.
Moraine turned away abruptly.
We must sleep while we can and leave it first light. If the Dark One's hand grows too strong... We must reach Camelin quickly.
Angrily, Nynaeve snatched up her bag and stalked off before Perrin could speak. He started to growl an oath, but a thought hit him like a blow, and he sat there gaping silently.
Moraine knew.
The Aes Sedai knew about the wolves, and she thought it could be the Dark One's doing. A shiver ran through him. Hastily, he shrugged back into his shirt, tucking it in awkwardly, and pulled his coat and cloak back on. The clothing did not help very much. He felt chilled right down to his bones, his marrow like frozen jelly. Lan dropped to the ground, cross-legged, tossing back his cloak. Perrin was glad of that. It was unpleasant looking at the warder and having his eyes slide past. For a long moment, they simply stared at one another. The hard planes of the warder's face were unreadable, but in his eyes, Perrin thought he saw...
something. Sympathy. Curiosity? Both?
You know,
he said, and Lan nodded.
I know some, not all. Did it just come to you, or did you meet a guide, an intermediary?
There was a man, Perrin said slowly. He knows, but does he think the same as Moraine?
He said his name was Elias. Elias Machira.
Lan drew a deep breath, and Perrin looked at him sharply.
You know him?
I knew him. He taught me much about the Blight and about this.
Lan touched his sword hilt.
He was a warder before what happened. The Red Aja.
He glanced to where Moraine was, lying before the fire. It was the first time Perrin could remember any uncertainty in the warder. At Shadar Logoth, Lan had been sure and strong, and when he was facing Fades and Trollocs. He was not afraid now, Perrin was convinced of that, but he was wary, as if he might say too much, as if what he said could be dangerous.
I've heard of the Red Aja, he told Lan. And most of what you've heard is wrong, no doubt. You must understand there are factions within Tar-Valon. Some would fight the Dark One one way, some another. The goal is the same, but the differences can mean lives changed or ended, the lives of men or nations. He is well, Elias?
I think so. The White Cloak said they killed him, but Dapple...
Perrin glanced at the warder uncomfortably.
I don't know.
Lan seemed to accept that he did not, reluctantly, and it emboldened him to go on.
This communicating with the wolves, Moraine seems to think it's something the Dark One did.
It isn't, is it? He would not believe Elias was a dark friend. But Lan hesitated, and sweat started on Perrin's face, chill beads made colder by the night. They were sliding down his cheeks by the time the warder spoke.
Not in itself, no. Some believe it is, but they are wrong. It was old and lost long before the Dark One was found. But what of the chance involved, blacksmith? Sometimes the pattern has a randomness to it, to our eyes at least. But what chance that you should meet a man who could guide you in this thing, and you one who could follow the guiding? The pattern is forming a great web, what some call the lace of ages, and you lads are central to it. I don't think there is much chance left in your lives now. Have you been chosen out, then? And if so, by the light or by the shadow?
The Dark One can't touch us unless we name him. Immediately Perrin thought of the dreams of Balsamon, the dreams that were more than dreams. He scrubbed the sweat off his face.
He can't.
Rock hard stubborn, the warder mused. Maybe stubborn enough to save yourself in the end. Remember the times we live in, blacksmith. Remember what Moraine said I told you. In these times many things are dissolving and breaking apart. Old barriers weaken, old walls crumble. The barriers between what is and what was, between what is and what will be. His voice turned grim. The walls of the Dark One's prison. This may be the end of an age. We may see a new age born before we die. Or perhaps it is the end of ages, the end of time itself, the end of the world.
Suddenly he grinned, but his grin was as dark as a scowl. His eyes sparkled merrily, laughing at the foot of the gallows.
But that's not for us to worry about, eh, blacksmith? We'll fight the shadow as long as we have breath, and if it overruns us, we'll go under biting and clawing. You two rivers folk are too stubborn to surrender. Don't you worry whether the Dark One has stirred in your life. You are back among friends now. Remember, the wheel weaves as the wheel wills, and even the Dark One cannot change that. Not with Moraine to watch over you. But we had better find your friends soon.
What do you mean?
They have no Aes Sedai touching the true source to protect them. Blacksmith, perhaps the walls have weakened enough for the Dark One himself to touch events. Not with a free hand, or we'd be done already. But maybe tiny shiftings in the threads. A chance turning of one corner instead of another. A chance meeting. A chance word. Or what seems like chance. And they could be so far under the shadow, not even Moraine could bring them back.
We have to find them, Perrin said, and the warder gave a grunt of a laugh.
What have I been saying? Get some sleep, blacksmith.
Lan's cloak swung back around him as he stood. In the faint light from fire and moon, he seemed almost part of the shadows beyond.
We have a hard few days to Camelin. Just you pray we find them there.
But Moraine, she can find them anywhere, can't she? She says she can.
But can't she find them in time? If the Dark One is strong enough to take a hand himself, time is running out. You pray we find them in Camelin, blacksmith, or we may all be lost.
Chapter 39 Weaving of the Web. Rand looked down on the crowds from the high window of his room in the Queen's Blessing. They ran shouting along the street, all streaming in the same direction, waving pennants and banners, the white lion standing guard in a thousand fields of red. Camelinners and Outlanders, they ran together, and for a change no one appeared to want to bash anyone else's head. Today, maybe, there was only one faction. He turned from the window, grinning. Next to the day when Egwene and Perrin walked in, alive and laughing over what they had seen, this was the day he had been waiting for most.
"Are you coming?"
he asked again. Matt glowered from where he lay curled up in a ball on his bed.
"Take that Trolloc you're so friendly with."
"Blood and ashes, Matt, he's not a Trolloc. You're just being stubborn stupid. How many times do you want to have this argument?
Light, it's not as if you'd never heard of Ogier before."
"I never heard they look like Trollocs."
Matt pushed his face into his pillow and curled himself tighter.
Stubborn stupid, Rand muttered. How long are you going to hide up here? I'm not going to keep bringing you your meals up all those stairs forever. You could do with a bath, too.
Matt shrugged around on the bed as if he were trying to burrow deeper into it. Rand sighed, then went to the door.
Last chance to go together, Matt. I'm leaving now.
He closed the door slowly, hoping that Matt would change his mind. But his friend did not stir. The door clicked shut. In the hallway, he leaned against the doorframe. Master Gill said there was an old woman two streets over, Mother Grubb, who sold herbs and poultices besides birthing babies, tending the sick, and telling fortunes. She sounded a little like a wisdom. Nynaeve was who Matt needed, or maybe Moraine, but Mother Grubb was who he had. Bringing her to the Queen's blessing might bring the wrong kind of attention as well, though, if she would even come. For her, as well as for Matt and him. Herbalists and hedge doctors were lying low in Camelin right now. There was talk against anyone who did any kind of healing or fortune-telling. Every night the dragon's fang was scrawled on doors with a free hand, sometimes even in the daylight, and people might forget who had cured their fevers and poulticed their toothaches when the cry of Dark Friend went up. That was the temper in the city. It was not as if Matt were really sick. He ate everything Rand carried up from the kitchen. He would take nothing from anyone else's hand, though, and never complained about aches or fever. He just refused to leave the room. But Rand had been sure today would bring him out. He settled his cloak on his shoulders and hitched his sword belt around so the sword, and the red cloth wrapped around it, was covered more. At the foot of the stairs, he met Master Gill just starting up.
"There's someone been asking after you in the city,"
the innkeeper said around his pipe. Rand felt a surge of hope.
"Asking after you and those friends of yours by name. You younglings, anyway. Seems to want you three lads most."
Anxiety replaced hope.
"Who?"
Rand asked. He still could not help glancing up and down the hall. Except for they two, it was empty, from the exit into the alley to the common room door.
"Don't know his name. Just heard about him. I hear most things in Camelin eventually."
"Beggar!"
the innkeeper grunted.
"Half mad, I hear. Even so, he could take the Queen's bounty at the palace, even with things as hard as they are. On high days, the Queen gives it out with her own hands, and there's never anyone turned away for any reason. No one needs to beg in Camelin. Even a man under warrant can't be arrested while he's taking the Queen's bounty."
"A dark friend?"
Rand said reluctantly. "If the dark friends know our names..."
"You've got dark friends on the brain, young fellow. They're around, certainly, but just because the white cloaks have everybody stirred up is no reason for you to think the city's full of them. Do you know what rumor those idiots have started now? Strange shapes. Can you believe it? Strange shapes creeping around outside the city in the night."
The innkeeper chuckled till his belly shook. Rand did not feel like laughing. Chaim Kinch had talked about strange shapes, and there had surely enough been a fade back there.
"What kind of shapes?"
"What kind? I don't know what kind. Strange shapes. Trollocs, probably. The Shadowman. Luz Theron Kinslayer himself come back 50 feet high. What kind of shapes do you think people will imagine now the ideas in their heads? It's none of our worry."
Master Gill eyed him for a moment.
"Going out, are you? Well, I can't say I care for it myself, even today. But there's hardly anybody left here but me. Not your friend?"
"Matt's not feeling very well. Maybe later."
"Well, be that as it may. You watch yourself now. Even today, good Queen's men will be outnumbered out there. Light burn the day I ever thought to see it so. Best you leave by the alleyway. There's two of those blood-bedamned traitors sitting across the street watching my front door. They know where I stand by the light."
Rand stuck his head out and looked both ways before slipping into the alley. A bulky man Master Gill had hired stood at the head of the alley, leaning on his spear and watching the people run past with an apparent lack of interest. It was only apparent, Rand knew. The fellow, his name was Lamgwin, saw everything through those heavy-lidded eyes, and for all his bullish bulk, he could move like a cat. He also thought Queen Morgaze was the light made flesh, or near enough. There were a dozen like him scattered around the Queen's Blessing. Lamgwen's ear twitched when Rand reached the mouth of the alley, but he never took his disinterest off the street. Rand knew the man had heard him coming.
"Watch your back today, man."
Lamgwen's voice sounded like gravel in a pan.
"When the trouble starts, you'll be a handy one to have here. Not somewhere with a knife in your back."
Rand glanced at the blocky man, but his surprise was muted. He always tried to keep the sword out of sight, but this was not the first time one of Master Gil's men had assumed he would know his way in a fight. Lamgwen did not look back at him. The man's job was guarding the inn, and he did it. Pushing his sword back a little further under his cloak, Rand joined the flow of people. He saw the two men the innkeeper had mentioned, standing on upturned barrels across the street from the inn so they could see over the crowd. He did not think they noticed him coming out of the alley. They made no secret of their allegiance. Not only were their swords wrapped in white, tied with red, they wore white armbands and white cockades on their hats. He had not been in Camelon long before learning that red wrappings on a sword, or a red armband or cockade, meant support for Queen Morghais. White, said the Queen, and her involvement with Aes Sedai and Tar Valon, were to blame for everything that had gone wrong. For the weather and the failed crops. Maybe even for the false dragon. He did not want to get involved in Camelon politics. Only it was too late now. It was not just that he had already chosen, by accident, but there it was. Matters in the city had gone beyond letting anyone stay neutral. Even outlanders wore cockades and armbands, or wrapped their swords, and more wore the white than the red. Maybe some of them did not think that way, but they were far from home, and that was the way sentiment was running in Camelon. Men who supported the Queen went about in groups for their own protection when they went out at all. Today, though, it was different. On the surface, at least. Today, Camelon celebrated a victory of the light over the shadow. Today, the false dragon was being brought into the city to be displayed before the Queen before he was taken north to Tar Valon. No one talked about that part of it. No one but the Aes Sedai could deal with a man who could actually wield the One Power, of course, but no one wanted to talk about it. The light had defeated the shadow, and soldiers from Andor had been in the forefront of the battle. For today, that was all that was important. For today, everything else could be forgotten. Or could it? Rand wondered. The crowd ran, singing and waving banners, laughing. But men displaying the red kept together in knots of 10 or 20, and there were no women or children with them. He thought there were at least 10 men showing white for every one proclaiming allegiance to the Queen. Not for the first time he wished white cloth had been the cheaper. But would Master Gil have helped if you'd been showing the white? The crowd was so thick that jostling was inevitable. Even white cloaks did not enjoy their little open spaces in the throng today. As Rand let the crowd carry him toward the inner city, he realized that not all animosities were being reined in. He saw one of the children of the light, one of three, bumped so hard he almost fell. The white cloak barely caught himself and started an angry oath at the man who had bumped him when another man staggered him with a deliberate, aimed shoulder. Before matters could go any further, the white cloak's companions pulled him over to the side of the street to where they could shelter in a doorway. The three seemed caught between their normal glaring stare and disbelief. The crowd streamed on by as if none had noticed, and perhaps none had. No one would have dared do such a thing 2 days earlier. More, Rand realized, the men who had done the bumping wore white cockades on their hats. It was widely believed the white cloak supported those who opposed the Queen and her Aes Sedai advisor, but that made no difference. Men were doing things of which they had never before thought. Jostling a white cloak today. Tomorrow, perhaps pulling down a queen. Suddenly he wished there were a few more men close to him showing red. Jostled by white cockades and armbands, he abruptly felt very alone. The white cloaks noticed him looking at them and stared back as if meeting a challenge. He let a singing swirl in the crowd sweep him out of their sight and joined in their song. Forward the lion, forward the lion. The white lion takes the field. Roar defiance at the shadow, forward the lion. Forward Andor triumphant. The route that would bring the false dragon into Camelon was well known. Those streets themselves were kept clear by solid lines of the Queen's guards and red-cloaked pikemen, but people packed the edges of them, shoulder to shoulder, even the windows and the rooftops. Rand worked his way into the inner city, trying to get closer to the palace. He had some thought of actually seeing Loghain displayed before the queen. To see the false dragon and a queen, both. That was something he had never dreamed of back home. The inner city was built on hills, and much of what the Ogier had made still remained. Where streets in the new city mostly ran every which way in a crazy quilt, here they followed the curves of the hills as if they were a natural part of the earth. Sweeping rises and dips presented new and surprising vistas at every turn. Parks seen from different angles, even from above, where their walls and monuments made patterns pleasing to the eye, though barely touched with green. Towers suddenly revealed, tile-covered walls glittering in the sunlight with 100 changing colors. Sudden rises where the gaze was thrown out across the entire city, to the rolling plains and forests beyond. All in all, it would have been something to see, if not for the crowd that hurried him along before he had a chance to really take it in. And all those curving streets made it impossible to see very far ahead. Abruptly, he was swept around a bend, and there was the palace. The streets, even following the natural contours of the land, had been laid out to spiral in on this. This gleeman's tale of pale spires and golden domes and intricate stonework traceries, with the banner of Andor waving from every prominence, a centerpiece for which all the other vistas had been designed. It seemed more sculpted by an artist than simply built like ordinary buildings. That glimpse showed him he would get no nearer. No one was being allowed close to the palace. Queen's guards made scarlet ranks 10 deep flanking the palace gates. Along the tops of the white walls, on high balconies and towers, more guards stood rigidly straight, bows precisely slanted across the breastplated chests. They, too, looked like something out of a gleeman's tale, a guard of honor. But Rand did not believe that was why they were there. The clamoring crowd lining the streets was almost solid with white-wrapped swords, white armbands, and white cockades. Only here and there was the white wall broken by a knot of red. The red-uniformed guards seemed a thin barrier against all that white. Giving up on making his way closer to the palace, he sought a place where he could use his height to advantage. He did not have to be in the front row to see everything. The crowd shifted constantly, people shoving to get nearer the front, people hurrying off to what they thought was a better vantage point. In one of those shifts, he found himself only 3 people from the open street, and all in front of him were shorter than he, including the pikemen. Almost everyone was. People crowded against him from both sides, sweating from the press of so many bodies. Those behind him muttered about not being able to see and tried to wriggle past. He stood his ground, making an impervious wall with those to either side. He was content. When the false dragon passed by, he would be close enough to see the man's face clearly. Across the street and down toward the gates to the new city, a ripple passed through the tight-packed crowd. Around the curve, an eddy of people was drawing back to let something go by. It was not like the clear space that followed the white cloaks on any day but today. These people jerked themselves back with startled glances that became grimaces of distaste. Pressing themselves out of the way, they turned their faces from whatever it was, but watched out of the corners of their eyes until it was past. Other eyes around him noted the disturbance, too. Keyed for the coming of the dragon, but with nothing to do now but wait, the crowd found anything at all worthy of comment. He heard speculation ranging from an Aes Sedai to Loghain himself, and a few coarser suggestions that brought rough laughter from the men and disdainful sniffs from the women. The ripple meandered through the crowd, drawing closer to the edge of the street as it came. No one seemed to hesitate in letting it go where it wanted, even if that meant losing a good spot for viewing as the crowd flowed back in on itself behind the passing. Finally, directly across from Rand, the crowd bulged into the street, pushing aside red-cloaked pikemen who struggled to shove them back, and broke open. The stooped shape that shuffled hesitantly out into the open looked more like a pile of filthy rags than a man. Rand heard murmurs of disgust around him. The ragged man paused on the far edge of the street. His cowl, torn and stiff with dirt, swung back and forth as if searching for something or listening. Abruptly, he gave a wordless cry and flung out a dirty claw of a hand pointing straight at Rand. Immediately, he began to scuttle across the street like a bug. The beggar. Whatever ill chance had led the man to find him like this, Rand was suddenly sure that, dark friend or not, he did not want to meet him face to face. He could feel the beggar's eyes, like greasy water on his skin. Especially he did not want the man close to him here, surrounded by people balanced on the brink of violence. The same voices that had laughed before now cursed him as he pushed his way back, away from the street. He hurried, knowing the densely packed mass through which he had to shove and wriggle would give way before the filthy man. Struggling to force a path through the crowd, he staggered and almost fell when he abruptly broke free. Flailing his arms to keep his balance, he turned the stagger into a run. People pointed at him. He was the only one not pressing the other way, and running at that. Shouts followed him. His cloak flapped behind him, exposing his red-clad sword. When he realized that, he ran faster. A lone supporter of the queen, running, could well spark a white-cockaded mob to pursuit, even today. He ran, letting his long legs eat paving stones. Not until the shouts were left far behind did he allow himself to collapse against a wall, panting. He did not know where he was, except that he was still within the inner city. He could not remember how many twists and turns he had taken along those curving streets. Poised to run again, he looked back the way he had come. Only one person moved on the street, a woman walking placidly along with her shopping basket. Almost everyone in the city was gathered for a glimpse of the false dragon. He can't have followed me. I must have left him behind. The beggar would not give up, he was sure of it, though he could not say why. That ragged shape would be working its way through the crowds at that very minute, searching, and if Rand returned to see Loghain, he ran the risk of a meeting. For a moment he considered going back to the queen's blessing, but he was sure he would never get another chance to see a queen, and he hoped he would never have another to see a false dragon. There seemed to be something cowardly in letting a bent beggar, even a dark friend, chase him into hiding. He looked around, considering. The way the inner city was laid out, buildings were kept low, if there were buildings at all, so that someone standing at a particular spot would have nothing to interrupt the planned view. There had to be places from where he could see the procession pass with the false dragon. Even if he could not see the queen, he could see Loghain. Suddenly determined, he set off. In the next hour he found several such places, every last one already packed cheek to cheek with people avoiding the crush along the procession route. They were a solid front of white cockades and armbands. No red at all. Thinking what the sight of his sword might do in a crowd like that, he slipped away carefully and quickly. Shouting floated up from the new city, cries and the blaring of trumpets, the martial beat of drums. Loghain and his escort were already in Camelin, already on the way to the palace. Dispirited, he wandered the all but empty streets, still half-heartedly hoping to find some way to see Loghain. His eyes fell on the slope, bare of buildings, rising above the street where he was walking. In a normal spring, the slope would have been an expanse of flowers and grass, but now it was brown all the way to the high wall along its crest, a wall over which the tops of trees were visible. This part of the street had not been designed for any grand view, but just ahead, over the rooftops, he could see some of the palace spires topped by white lion banners fluttering in the wind. He was not sure exactly where the curve of the street ran after it rounded the hill beyond his sight, but he suddenly had a thought about that hilltop wall. The drums and trumpets were drawing nearer, the shouting growing louder. Anxiously, he scrambled up the slope. It was not meant to be climbed, but he dug his boots into the dead sod and pulled himself up, using leafless shrubs as handholds. Panting as much with desire as effort, he scrambled the last yards to the wall. It reared above him, easily twice his height and more. The air thundered with the drumbeat, rang with trumpet blasts. The face of the wall had been left much in the natural state of the stone, the huge blocks fitted together so well that the joints were nearly invisible, the roughness making it seem almost a natural cliff. Rand grinned. The cliffs just beyond the sandhills were higher, and even Perrin had climbed those. His hand sought rocky knobs, his booted feet found ridges. The drums raced him as he climbed. He refused to let them win. He would reach the top before they reached the palace. In his haste, the stone tore his hands and scraped his knees through his breeches, but he flung his arms over the top and heaved himself up with a sense of victory. Hastily he twisted himself around to a seat on the flat, narrow top of the wall. The leafy branches of a towering tree stuck out over his head, but he had no thought for that. He looked across tiled rooftops, but from the wall his line of sight was clear. He leaned out just a little and could see the palace gate and the queen's guards drawn up there, and the expectant crowd. Expectant. Their shouts drowned out by the thunder of drums and trumpets, but waiting still. He grinned. I won. Even as he settled in place, the first part of the procession rounded the final curve before the palace. 20 ranks of trumpeters came first, splitting the air with peal after triumphant peal, a fanfare of victory. Behind them, as many drummers thundered. Then came the banners of Camelin, white lions on red, borne by mounted men, followed by the soldiers of Camelin, rank on rank on rank of horsemen, armor gleaming, lances proudly held, crimson pennants fluttering. Treble rows of pikemen and archers flanked them, and came on after the horsemen began passing between the waiting guards and through the palace gates. The last of the foot soldiers rounded the curve, and behind them was a massive wagon. 16 horses pulled it in hitches of 4. In the center of its flat bed was a large cage of iron bars, and on each corner of the wagon bed sat 2 women, watching the cage as intently as if the procession and the crowd did not exist. Aes Sedai, he was certain. Between the wagon and the footman, and to either side, rode a dozen warders, their cloaks swirling and tangling the eye. If the Aes Sedai ignored the crowd, the warders scanned it as if there were no other guards but they. With all of that, it was the man in the cage who caught and held Rand's eyes. He was not close enough to see Loghain's face, as he wanted to, but suddenly he thought he was as close as he cared for. The false dragon was a tall man, with long, dark hair curling around his broad shoulders. He held himself upright against the sway of the wagon with one hand on the bars over his head. His clothes seemed ordinary, a cloak and coat and breeches that would have not caused comment in any farming village. But the way he wore them, the way he held himself... Loghain was a king in every inch of him. The cage might as well not have been there. He held himself erect, head high, and looked over the crowd as if they had come to do him honor. And wherever his gaze swept, there the people fell silent, staring back in awe. When Loghain's eyes left them, they screamed with redoubled fury as if to make up for their silence, but it made no difference in the way the man stood, or in the silence that passed along with him. As the wagon rolled through the palace gates, he turned to look back at the assembled masses. They howled at him, beyond words, a wave of sheer animal hate and fear, and Loghain threw back his head and laughed as the palace swallowed him. Other contingents followed behind the wagons, with banners representing more who had fought and defeated the false dragon. The golden bees of Ilion, the 3 white crescents of Tyr, the rising sun of Carrion, others, many others, of nations and of cities, and of great men with their own trumpets, their own drums to thunder their grandeur. It was anticlimactic after Loghain. Rand leaned out a bit further to try to catch one last sight of the caged man. He was defeated, wasn't he? Light, he wouldn't be in a bloody cage if he wasn't defeated. Overbalanced, he slipped and grabbed at the top of the wall, pulled himself back to a somewhat safer seat. With Loghain gone, he became aware of the burning in his hands, where the stone had scraped his palms and fingers. Yet he could not shake free of the images. The cage and the Aes Sedai. Loghain undefeated. No matter the cage, that had not been a defeated man. He shivered and rubbed his stinging hands on his thighs. Why were the Aes Sedai watching him? He wondered aloud.
They're keeping him from touching the true source, silly.
He jerked to look up toward the girl's voice, and suddenly his precarious seat was gone. He had only time to realize that he was toppling backward, falling, when something struck his head, and a laughing Loghain chased him into spinning darkness. Chapter 40 The Web Tightens. It seemed to Rand that he was sitting at table with Loghain and Moraine. The Aes Sedai and the false dragon sat watching him silently, as if neither knew the other was there. Abruptly he realized the walls of the room were becoming indistinct, fading off into gray. A sense of urgency built in him. Everything was going, blurring away. When he looked back to the table, Moraine and Loghain had vanished, and Balsamon sat there instead. Rand's whole body vibrated with urgency. It hummed inside his head, louder and louder. The hum became the pounding of blood in his ears. With a jerk, he sat up and immediately groaned and clutched his head, swaying. His whole skull hurt. His left hand found sticky dampness in his hair. He was sitting on the ground on green grass. That troubled him, vaguely, but his head spun and everything he looked at lurched, and all he could think of was lying down until it stopped. The wall. The girl's voice. Steadying himself with one hand flat on the grass, he looked around slowly. He had to do it slowly. When he tried to turn his head quickly, everything started whirling again. He was in a garden or a park. A slate-paved walk meandered by through flowering bushes not 6 feet away, with a white stone bench beside it and a leafy arbor over the bench for shade. He had fallen inside the wall. And the girl? He found the tree close behind his back and found her, too, climbing down out of it. She reached the ground and turned to face him, and he blinked and groaned again. A deep blue velvet cloak, lined with pale fur, rested on her shoulders, its hood hanging down behind her waist with a cluster of silver bells at the peak. They jingled when she moved. A silver filigree circlet held her long red-gold curls and delicate silver rings hung at her ears, while a necklace of heavy silver links and dark green stones he thought were emeralds lay around her throat. Her pale blue dress was smudged with bark stains from her tree climbing, but it was still silk, and embroidered with painstakingly intricate designs, the skirt slashed with inserts, the color of rich cream. A wide belt of woven silver encircled her waist, and velvet slippers peeked from under the hem of her dress. He had only ever seen two women dressed in this fashion, Moraine and the dark friend who had tried to kill Matt and him. He could not begin to imagine who would choose to climb trees in clothes like that, but he was sure she had to be someone important. The way she was looking at him redoubled the impression. She did not seem in the least troubled at having a stranger tumble into her garden. There was a self-possession about her that made him think of Nynaeve or Moraine. He was so enmeshed in worrying whether or not he had gotten himself into trouble, whether or not she was someone who could and would call the Queen's Guard even on a day when they had other things to occupy them, that it took him a few moments to see past the elaborate clothes and lofty attitude to the girl herself. She was perhaps 2 or 3 years younger than he, tall for a girl, and beautiful. Her face a perfect oval framed by that mass of sunburst curls, her lips full and red, her eyes bluer than he could believe. She was completely different from Egwene in height and face and body, but every bit as beautiful. He felt a twinge of guilt, but told himself that denying what his eyes saw would not bring Egwene safely to Camelin one whit faster. A scrabbling sound came from up in the tree, and bits of bark fell, followed by a boy dropping lightly to the ground behind her. He was a head taller than she and a little older, but his face and hair marked him as her close kin. His coat and cloak were red and white and gold, embroidered and brocaded, and for a male, even more ornate than hers. That increased Rand's anxiety. Only on a feast day would any ordinary man dress in anything like that, and never with that much grandeur. This was no public park. Perhaps the guards were too busy to bother with trespassers. The boy studied Rand over the girl's shoulder, fingering the dagger at his waist. It seemed more a nervous habit than any thought that he might use it. Not completely, though. The boy had the same self-possession as the girl, and they both looked at him as if he were a puzzle to be solved. He had the odd feeling that the girl, at least, was cataloging everything about him, from the condition of his boots to the state of his cloak.
"We will never hear the end of this, Elaine, if Mother finds out," the boy said suddenly. "She told us to stay in our rooms, but you just had to get a look at Loghain, didn't you? Now look what it has got us." "Be quiet, Gawain."
She was clearly the younger of the two, but she spoke as though she took it for granted that he would obey. The boy's face struggled as if he had more to say, but to Rand's surprise he held his peace.
"Are you all right?"
she said suddenly. It took Rand a minute to realize she was speaking to him. When he did, he tried to struggle to his feet.
"I'm fine. I just..."
He tottered, and his legs gave way. He sat back down hard. His head swam.
I'll just climb back over the wall, he muttered. He attempted to stand again, but she put a hand on his shoulder, pressing him down. He was so dizzy the slight pressure was enough to hold him in place.
You are hurt.
Gracefully, she knelt beside him. Her fingers gently parted the blood-matted hair on the left side of his head.
You must have struck a branch coming down. You'll be lucky if you didn't break anything more than your scalp. I don't think I ever saw anyone as skillful at climbing as you. But you don't do so well falling.
You'll get blood on your hands, he said, drawing back. Firmly, she pulled his head back to where she could get at it.
Hold still.
She did not speak sharply, but again there was that note in her voice as if she expected to be obeyed.
It does not look too bad, thank the light.
From pockets on the inside of her cloak, she began taking out an array of tiny vials and twisted packets of paper, finishing with a handful of wadded bandage. He stared at the collection in amazement. It was the sort of thing he would have expected a wizard to carry, not someone dressed as she was. She had gotten blood on her fingers, he saw, but it did not seem to bother her.
Give me your water flask, Gawain, she said. I need to wash this.
The boy she called Gawain unfastened a leather bottle from his belt and handed it to her, then squatted easily at Rand's feet with his arms folded on his knees. Elaine went about what she was doing in a very workmanlike manner. He did not flinch at the sting of cold water when she washed the cut in his scalp, but she held the top of his head with one hand as if she expected him to try to pull away again, and would have none of it. The ointment she smoothed on after, from one of her small vials, soothed almost as much as one of Nynaeve's preparations would have. Gawain smiled at him as she worked, a calming smile, as if he too expected Rand to jerk away and maybe even run.
She's always finding stray cats and birds with broken wings. You are the first human being she has had to work on.
He hesitated, then added,
Do not be offended. I am not calling you a stray.
It was not an apology, just a statement of fact.
No offense taken, Rand said stiffly.
But the pair were acting as if he were a skittish horse.
She does know what she is doing, Gawain said. She has had the best teachers, so do not fear, you are in good hands.
Elaine pressed some of the bandaging against his temple and pulled a silk scarf from her belt, blue and cream and gold. For any girl in Emmons Field, it would have been a treasured feast day cloth. Elaine deftly began winding it around his head to hold the wad of bandage in place.
You can't use that, he protested.
She went on winding.
I told you to hold still, she said calmly.
Rand looked at Gawain. Does she always expect everybody to do what she tells them? A flash of surprise crossed the young man's face, and his mouth tightened with amusement.
Most of the time she does, and most of the time they do. Hold this, Elaine said. Put your hand there while I tie.
She exclaimed at the sight of his hands.
You did not do that, falling. Climbing where you should not have been climbing is more like it.
Quickly finishing her knot, she turned his hands palms upward in front of him, muttering to herself about how little water was left. The washing made the lacerations burn, but her touch was surprisingly delicate.
Hold still this time.
The vial of ointment was produced again. She spread it thinly along the scrapes, all of her attention apparently on rubbing it in without hurting him. A coolness spread through his hands, as if she were rubbing the torn places away.
Most of the time they do exactly what she says, Gawain went on with an affectionate grin at the top of her head. Most people. Not Mother, of course. Or Elida. And not Linny. Linny was her nurse. You can't give order to someone who switched you for stealing figs when you were little. And even not so little.
Elaine raised her head long enough to give him a dangerous look. He cleared his throat and carefully blanked his expression before hurrying on.
And Gareth, of course. No one gives orders to Gareth. Not even Mother, Elaine said, bending her head back over Rand's hands. She makes suggestions, and he always does what she suggests, but I've never heard her give him a command.
She shook her head.
I don't know why that always surprises you, Gawain answered her. Even you don't try telling Gareth what to do. He's served three queens and been captain general and first prince regent for two. I dare say there are some think he's more a symbol of the throne of Andor than the Queen is. Mother should go ahead and marry him, she said absently.
Her attention was on Rand's hands.
She wants to. She can't hide it from me. And it would solve so many problems.
Gowan shook his head.
One of them must bend first. Mother cannot, and Garth will not. If she commanded him, he would obey, I think. But she won't. You know she won't.
Abruptly, they turned to stare at Rand. He had the feeling they had forgotten he was there.
Who?
He had to stop to wet his lips.
Who is your mother?
Elaine's eyes widened in surprise, but Gowan spoke in an ordinary tone that made his words all the more jarring.
Morgaze, by the grace of the light, Queen of Andor, protector of the realm, defender of the people, high seat of the House of Trakand.
The Queen,
Rand muttered, shock spreading through him in waves of numbness. For a minute he thought his head was going to begin spinning again.
Don't attract any attention. Just fall into the Queen's garden and let the daughter heir tend your cuts like a hedge doctor.
He wanted to laugh, and knew it for the fringes of panic.
Drawing a deep breath, he scrambled hastily to his feet. He held himself tightly in rein against the urge to run, but the need to get away filled him, to get away before anyone else discovered him there.
Elaine and Gowan watched him calmly, and when he leaped up, they rose gracefully, not hurried in the least. He put up a hand to pull the scarf from his head, and Elaine seized his elbow.
"Stop that. You will start the bleeding again."
Her voice was still calm, still sure that he would do as he was told.
"I have to go," Rand said. "I'll just climb back over the wall and—"
"You really didn't know."
For the first time she seemed as startled as he was.
"Do you mean you climbed up on that wall to see Loghain without even knowing where you were? You could have gotten a much better view down in the streets."
"I don't like crowds," he mumbled.
He sketched a bow to each of them.
"If you'll pardon me, my lady—"
In the stories, royal courts were full of people all calling one another Lord and Lady and Royal Highness and Majesty. But if he had ever heard the correct form of address for the daughter heir, he could not think clearly enough to remember. He could not think clearly about anything beyond the need to be far away.
"If you will pardon me, I'll just leave now. Thank you for the—"
He touched the scarf around his head.
"Thank you."
"Without even telling us your name," Gowan said. "A poor payment for Elaine's care. I've been wondering about you. You sound like an Andorman, though not a Camelinar, certainly, but you look like— well, you know our names. Courtesy would suggest you give us yours."
Looking longingly at the wall, Rand gave his right name before he thought what he was doing, and even added,
"From Emmons Field in the Two Rivers."
"From the west," Gowan murmured. "Very far to the west."
Rand looked around at him sharply. There had been a note of surprise in the young man's voice, and Rand caught some of it still on his face when he turned. Gowan replaced it with a pleasant smile so quickly, though, that he almost doubted what he had seen.
"Tobacco and wool," Gowan said. "I have to know the principal products of every part of the realm, of every land, for that matter, part of my training. Principal products and crafts, and what the people are like. Their customs, their strengths and weaknesses. It's said Two Rivers people are stubborn. They can be led if they think you are worthy, but the harder you try to push them, the harder they dig in. Elaine ought to choose her husband from there. It'll take a man with a will like stone to keep from being trampled by her."
Rand stared at him. Elaine was staring, too. Gowan looked as much under control as ever, but he was babbling.
Why?
"What's this?"
All three of them jumped at the sudden voice and spun to face it. The young man who stood there was the handsomest man Rand had ever seen, almost too handsome for masculinity. He was tall and slender, but his movements spoke of whipcord strength and a sure confidence. Dark of hair and eye, he wore his clothes only a little less elaborate in red and white than Gowan's, as if they were of no importance. One hand rested on his sword hilt, and his eyes were steady on Rand.
"Stand away from him, Elaine," the man said.
"You too, Gowan."
Elaine stepped in front of Rand, between him and the newcomer, head high and as confident as ever.
"He is a loyal subject of our mother, and a good queen's man. And he is under my protection, Galad."
Rand tried to remember what he had heard from Master Kinch and since from Master Gil. Galadadrid Damadrid was Elaine's half-brother, Elaine's and Gawain's, if he remembered correctly. The three shared the same father. Master Kinch might not have liked Tarangail Damadrid too well, neither did anyone else that he had heard, but the son was well thought of by wearers of the red and the white alike, if the talk in the city was any guide.
"I am aware of your fondness for strays, Elaine," the slender man said reasonably. "But the fellow is armed, and he hardly looks reputable. In these days we cannot be too careful. If he's a loyal queen's man, what is he doing here, where he does not belong? It is easy enough to change the wrappings on a sword, Elaine."
"He is here as my guest, Galad, and I vouch for him. Or have you appointed yourself my nurse to decide whom I may talk to and when?"
Her voice was rich with scorn, but Galad seemed unmoved.
"You know I make no claims for control over your actions, Elaine, but this guest of yours is not proper, and you know that as well as I. Gawain, help me convince her. Our mother would..."
"Enough," Elaine snapped. "You are right that you have no say over my actions, nor have you any right to judge them. You may leave me. Now."
Galad gave Gawain a rueful look. At one and the same time, it seemed to ask for help, while saying that Elaine was too headstrong to be helped. Elaine's face darkened, but just as she opened her mouth again, he bowed, in all formality, yet with the grace of a cat, took a step back, then turned and strode down the paved path, his long legs carrying him quickly out of sight beyond the arbor.
"I hate him," Elaine breathed. "He is vile and full of envy."
"There you go too far, Elaine," Gawain said. "Galad does not know the meaning of envy. Twice he has saved my life, with none to know if he held his hand. If he had not, he would be your first prince of the sword in my place."
"Never, Gawain. I would choose anyone before Galad. Anyone. The lowest stable boy."
Suddenly she smiled and gave her brother a mock-stern look.
"You say I am fond of giving orders. Well, I command you to let nothing happen to you. I command you to be my first prince of the sword when I take the throne. The light send that day is far off, and to lead the armies of Andor with the sort of honor Galad cannot dream of."
"As you command, my lady,"
Gawain laughed, his bow a parody of Galad's. Elaine gave Rand a thoughtful frown.
"Now we must get you out of here quickly."
"Galad always does the right thing," Gawain explained, "even when he should not. In this case, finding a stranger in the gardens, the right thing is to notify the palace guards, which I suspect he is on his way to do right this minute."
"Then it's time I was back over the wall," Rand said.
"A fine day for going unnoticed. I might as well carry a sign."
He turned to the wall, but Elaine caught his arm.
"Not after the trouble I went to with your hands. You'll only make fresh scrapes, and then let some back-alley crone put the light knows what on them. There is a small gate on the other side of the garden. It's overgrown, and no one but me even remembers it's there."
Suddenly Rand heard boots pounding toward them over the slate paving stones.
"Too late," Gawain muttered. "He must have started running as soon as he was out of eyeshot."
Elaine growled an oath, and Rand's eyebrows shot up. He had heard that one from the stableman at the Queen's Blessing, and had been shocked then. The next moment she was in cool self-possession once more. Gawain and Elaine appeared content to remain where they were, but he could not make himself stay for the Queen's guards with such equanimity. He started once more for the wall, knowing he would be no more than halfway up before the guards arrived, but unable to stand still. Before he had taken three steps, red-uniformed men burst into sight, breastplates catching the sun as they dashed up the path. Others came like breaking waves of scarlet and polished steel, seemingly from every direction. Some held drawn swords, others only waited to set their boots before raising bows and knocking feathered shafts. Behind the barred face guards, every eye was grim, and every broadhead arrow was pointed unwaveringly at him. Elaine and Gawain leaped as one, putting themselves between him and the arrows, their arms spread to cover him. He stood very still and kept his hands in plain sight, away from his sword. While the thud of boots and the creak of bowstrings still hung in the air, one of the soldiers, with the golden knot of an officer on his shoulder, shouted,
"My lady! My lord! Down, quickly!"
Despite her outstretched arms, Elaine drew herself up regally.
"You dare to bring bare steel into my presence, Talonvor? Gareth Bryn will have you mucking stables with the meanest trooper for this, if you are lucky."
The soldiers exchanged puzzled glances, and some of the bowmen uneasily half-lowered their bows. Only then did Elaine let her arms down, as if she had only held them up because she wished to. Gawain hesitated, then followed her example. Rand could count the bows that had not been lowered. The muscles of his stomach tensed, as though they could stop a broadhead shaft at 20 paces. The man with the officer's knot seemed the most perplexed of all.
"My lady, forgive me, but Lord Galadadrid reported a dirty peasant skulking in the gardens, armed and endangering my Lady Elaine and my Lord Gawain."
His eyes went to Rand, and his voice firmed.
"If my lady and my lord will please to step aside, I will take the villain into custody. There is too much riffraff in the city these days."
"I doubt very much if Galad reported anything of the kind," Elaine said. "Galad does not lie." "Sometimes I wish he would,"
Gawain said softly for Rand's ear.
"Just once. It might make living with him easier." "This man is my guest," Elaine continued, "and here under my protection. You may withdraw, Talonvor."
"I regret that will not be possible, my lady. As my lady knows, the Queen, your lady mother, has given orders regarding anyone on palace grounds without Her Majesty's permission, and word has been sent to Her Majesty of this intruder."
There was more than a hint of satisfaction in Talonvor's voice. Rand suspected the officer had had to accept other commands from Elaine that he did not think proper. This time the man was not about to, not when he had a perfect excuse. Elaine stared back at Talonvor. For once she seemed at a loss. Rand looked a question at Gawain, and Gawain understood.
"Prison," he murmured.
Rand's face went white, and the young man added quickly,
"Only for a few days, and you will not be harmed. You'll be questioned by Gareth Bryn, the Captain General personally, but you will be set free once it's clear you meant no harm."
He paused, hidden thoughts in his eyes.
"I hope you were telling the truth, Randalthor, from the Two Rivers." "You will conduct all three of us to my mother," Elaine announced suddenly.
A grin bloomed on Gawain's face. Behind the steel bars across his face, Talonvor appeared taken aback.
"My lady, I—"
"Or else conduct all three of us to a cell," Elaine said. "We will remain together. Or you give orders for hands to be laid upon my person."
Her smile was victorious, and the way Talonvor looked around as if he expected to find help in the trees said he too thought she had won.
"Won what? How?" "Mother is viewing Loghain," Gawain said softly, as if he had read Rand's thoughts. "And even if she was not busy, Talonvor would not dare troop into her presence with Elaine and me, as if we were under guard. Mother has a bit of a temper sometimes."
Rand remembered what Master Gillett said about Queen Morgaze.
"A bit of a temper?"
Another red-uniformed soldier came running down the path, skidding to a halt to salute with an arm across his chest. He spoke softly to Talonvor, and his words brought satisfaction back to Talonvor's face.
"The Queen, your lady mother," Talonvor announced, "commands me to bring the intruder to her immediately. It is also the Queen's command that my Lady Elaine and my Lord Gawain attend her. Also immediately."
Gawain winced, and Elaine swallowed hard. Her face composed, she still began industriously brushing the stains on her dress. Aside from dislodging a few pieces of bark, her effort did little good.
"If my lady pleases," Talonvor said smugly. "My lord."
The soldiers formed around them in a hollow box that started along the slate path, with Talonvor leading. Gawain and Elaine walked on either side of Rand, both appearing lost in unpleasant thoughts. The soldiers had sheathed their swords and returned arrows to quivers, but they were no less on guard than when they had had weapons in hand. They watched Rand as if they expected him at any moment to snatch his sword and try to cut his way to freedom.
"Try anything? I won't try anything. unnoticed? Ha!
Watching the soldiers watching him, he suddenly became aware of the garden. One thing had happened after another, each new shot coming before the last had had a chance to fade, and his surroundings had been a blur, except for the wall and his devout wish to be back on the other side of it. Now he saw the green grass that had only tickled the back of his mind before. Green. 100 shades of green. Trees and bushes, green and thriving, thick with leaves and fruit. Lush vines covering arbors over the path. Flowers everywhere. So many flowers spraying the garden with color. Some he knew, bright golden sunburst and tiny pink tallowed crimson starblaze, and purple Emmons glory, roses in every color from purest white to deep, deep red. But others were strange, so fanciful in shape and hue he wondered if they could be real.
"It's green," he whispered. "Green."
The soldiers muttered to themselves. Tallinvor gave them a sharp look over his shoulder, and they fell silent.
"Elida's work," Gowan said absently. "It is not right," Elaine said. "She asked if I wanted to pick out the one farm she could do the same for, while all around it the crops still failed. But it still isn't right for us to have flowers when there are people who do not have enough to eat."
She drew a deep breath and refilled her self-possession.
"Remember yourself," she told Rand briskly. "Speak up clearly when you are spoken to, and keep silent otherwise. And follow my lead. All will be well."
Rand wished he could share her confidence. It would have helped if Gowan had seemed to have it as well. As Tallinvor led them into the palace, he looked back at the garden, at all the green streaked with blossoms, colors wrought for a queen by an Aes Sedai's hand. He was in deep water, and there was no bank in sight. Palace servants filled the halls, in red liveries with collars and cuffs of white, the white line on the left breast of their tunics, scurrying about, intent on tasks that were not readily apparent. When the soldiers trooped by with Elaine and Gowan, and Rand in their midst, they stopped dead in their tracks to stare open-mouthed. Through the middle of all the consternation, a gray-striped tomcat wandered unconcernedly down the hall, weaving between the goggling servants. Suddenly the cat struck Rand as odd. He had been in Bearlon long enough to know that even the meanest shop had cats lurking in every corner. Since entering the palace, the Tom was the only cat he had seen.
"You don't have rats?" he said in disbelief.
Every place had rats.
"Elida doesn't like rats," Gowan muttered vaguely.
He was frowning worriedly down the hall, apparently already seeing the coming meeting with the queen.
"We never have rats. Both of you be quiet."
Elaine's voice was sharp, but as absent as her brother's.
"I'm trying to think."
Rand watched the cat over his shoulder until the guards took him round a corner, hiding the Tom from sight. A lot of cats would have made him feel better. It would have been nice if there was one thing normal about the palace, even if it was rats. The path Tallinvor took turned so many times that Rand lost his sense of direction. Finally, the young officer stopped before tall double doors of dark wood with a rich glow, not so grand as some they had passed, but still carved all over with rows of lions, finely wrought in detail. A liveried servant stood to either side.
"At least it isn't the Grand Hall," Gowan laughed unsteadily. "I never heard that Mother commanded anyone's head cut off from here."
He sounded as if he thought she might set a precedent. Tallinvor reached for Rand's sword, but Elaine moved to cut him off.
"He is my guest, and by custom and law, guests of the royal family may go armed even in Mother's presence. Or will you deny my word that he is my guest?"
Tallinvor hesitated, locking eyes with her, then nodded.
"Very well, my lady."
She smiled at Rand as Tallinvor stepped back, but it lasted only a moment.
"First rank to accompany me," Tallinvor commanded. "Announce the Lady Elaine and the Lord Gowan to Her Majesty,"
he told the doorkeepers.
"Also Guardsman Lieutenant Tallinvor, at Her Majesty's command, with the intruder under guard."
Elaine scowled at Tallinvor, but the doors were already swinging open. A sonorous voice sounded, announcing those who came. Grandly, Elaine swept through the doors, spoiling her regal entrance only a little by motioning for Rand to keep close behind her. Gowan squared his shoulders and strode in flanking her, one measured pace to her rear. Rand followed, uncertainly, keeping level with Gowan on her other side. Tollenvor stayed close to Rand, and 10 soldiers came with him. The doors closed silently behind them. Suddenly Elaine dropped into a deep curtsy, simultaneously bowing from the waist, and stayed there, holding her skirt wide. Rand gave a start, then hastily emulated Gowan and the other men, shifting awkwardly until he had it right. Down on his right knee, head bowed, bending forward to press the knuckles of his right hand against the marble tiles, his left hand resting on the end of his sword hilt. Gowan, without a sword, put his hand on his dagger the same way. Rand was just congratulating himself on getting it right when he noticed Tollenvor, his head still bent, glaring sideways at him from behind his face guard. Was I supposed to do something else? He was suddenly angry that Tollenvor expected him to know what to do when no one had told him. And angry over being afraid of the guards. He had done nothing to be fearful for. He knew his fear was not Tollenvor's fault, but he was angry at him anyway. Everyone held their positions, frozen as if waiting for the spring thaw. He did not know what they were waiting for, but he took the opportunity to study the place to which he had been brought. He kept his head down, just turning it enough to see. Tollenvor's scowl deepened, but he ignored it. The square chamber was about the size of the common room at the Queen's Blessing, its walls presenting hunting scenes carved in relief in stone of the purest white. The tapestries between the carvings were gentle images of bright flowers and brilliantly plumaged hummingbirds, except for the two at the far end of the room, where the white line of Andor stood taller than a man on scarlet fields. Those two hangings flanked a dais, and on the dais a carved and gilded throne, where sat the queen. A bluff, blocky man stood bareheaded by the queen's right hand in the red of the queen's guards, with 4 golden knots on the shoulder of his cloak and wide golden bands breaking the white of his cuffs. His temples were heavy with gray, but he looked as strong and immovable as a rock. That had to be the Captain General, Garth Bryn. Behind the throne and to the other side, a woman in deep green silk sat on a low stool, knitting something out of dark, almost black wool. At first, the knitting made Rand think she was old, but at second glance, he could not put an age to her at all. Young, old, he did not know. Her attention seemed to be entirely on her needles and yarn, just as if there were not a queen within arm's reach of her. She was a handsome woman, outwardly placid, yet there was something terrible in her concentration. There was no sound in the room except for the click of her needles. He tried to look at everything, yet his eyes kept going back to the woman with a gleaming wreath of finely wrought roses on her brow, the rose crown of Andor. A long red stole, the line of Andor marching along its length, hung over her silken dress of red and white pleats, and when she touched the Captain General's arm with her left hand, a ring in the shape of the great serpent, eating its own tail, glittered. Yet it was not the grandeur of clothes or jewelry, or even crown that drew Rand's eyes again and again. It was the woman who wore them. Morghese had her daughter's beauty matured and ripened. Her face and figure, her presence, filled the room like a light that dimmed the other two with her. If she had been a widow in Emmonsfield, she would have had a line of suitors outside her door even if she was the worst cook and the most slovenly housekeeper in the Two Rivers. He saw her studying him, and ducked his head, afraid she might be able to tell his thoughts from his face.
Light, thinking about the queen like she was a village woman. You fool!
You may rise,
Morghese said in a rich, warm voice that held Elaine's assurance of obedience 100 times over. Rand stood with the rest.
Mother,
Elaine began, but Morghese cut her off.
You have been climbing trees, it seems, daughter.
Elaine plucked a stray fragment of bark from her dress, and finding there was no place to put it, held it clenched in her hand.
In fact, Morghese went on calmly, it would seem that despite my orders to the contrary, you have contrived to take your look at this Loghain. Gowan, I have thought better of you. You must learn not only to obey your sister, but at the same time to be counterweight for her against disaster.
The queen's eyes swung to the blocky man beside her, then quickly away again. Bryn remained impassive, as if he had not noticed, but Rand thought those eyes noticed everything.
That, Gawain, is as much the duty of the First Prince as is leading the armies of Andor. Perhaps if your training is intensified, you will find less time for letting your sister lead you into trouble. I will ask the Captain General to see that you do not lack for things to do on the journey north.
Gawain shifted his feet as if about to protest, then bowed his head instead.
As you command, Mother.
Elaine grimaced.
Mother, Gawain cannot keep me out of trouble if he is not with me. It was for that reason alone he left his rooms. Mother, surely there could be no harm in just looking at Loghain. Almost everyone in the city was closer to him than we. Everyone in the city is not the daughter heir.
Sharpness underlay the Queen's voice.
I have seen this fellow Loghain from close, and he is dangerous, child. Caged, with Aes Sedai to guard him every minute, he is still as dangerous as a wolf.
He will be dealt with in Tar Valon.
The woman on the stool did not take her eyes from her knitting as she spoke.
What is important is that the people see that the light has once again vanquished the dark, and that they see you are part of that victory, Morghese.
Morghese waved a dismissive hand.
I would still rather he had never come near Camelon. Elaine, I know your mind. Mother,
Elaine protested,
I do mean to obey you. Truly I do. You do?
Morghese asked in mock surprise, then chuckled.
Yes, you do try to be a dutiful daughter, but you constantly test how far you may go. Well, I did the same with my mother. That spirit will stand you in good stead when you ascend to the throne. But you are not queen yet, child. You have disobeyed me and had your look at Loghain. Be satisfied with that. On the journey north, you will not be allowed within 100 paces of him. Neither you nor Gawain. If I did not know just how hard your lessons will be in Tar Valon, I would send Linny along to see that you obey. She, at least, seems able to make you do as you must.
Elaine bowed her head sullenly. The woman behind the throne seemed occupied with counting her stitches.
In 1 week, she said suddenly, you will be wanting to come home to your mother. In a month, you will be wanting to run away with the traveling people. But my sisters will keep you away from the unbeliever. That sort of thing is not for you. Not yet.
Abruptly, she turned on the stool to look intently at Elaine, all her placidity gone as if it had never been.
You have it in you to be the greatest queen that Andor has ever seen, that any land has seen in more than 1,000 years. It is for that we will shape you. If you have the strength for it.
Rand stared at her. She had to be Elaida, the Aes Sedai. Suddenly he was glad he had not come to her for help, no matter what her Aja. A sternness far beyond Moraine's radiated from her. He had sometimes thought of Moraine as steel covered with velvet. With Elaida, the velvet was only an illusion.
Enough, Elaida, Morghese said, frowning uneasily. She has heard that more than enough. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills.
For a moment she was silent, looking at her daughter.
Now there is the problem of this young man.
She gestured to Rand, without taking her eyes off Elaine's face.
And how and why he came here, and why you claimed guest right for him to your brother. May I speak, Mother?
When Morghese nodded her assent, Elaine told of events simply, from the time she first saw Rand climbing up the slope to the wall. He expected her to finish by proclaiming the innocence of what he had done, but instead she said,
Mother, often you tell me I must know our people, from the highest to the lowest, but whenever I meet any of them, it is with 12 attendants. How can I come to know anything real or true under such circumstances? In speaking with this young man, I have already learned more about the people of the Two Rivers, what kind of people they are, than I ever could from books. It says something that he has come so far and has put on the red, when so many incomers wear the white from fear. Mother, I beg you not to misuse a loyal subject, and one who has taught me much about the people you rule.
A loyal subject from the Two Rivers.
Morghese sighed.
My child,
You should pay more heed to those books. The Two Rivers has not seen a tax collector in 6 generations, nor the Queen's guards in 7. I dare say they seldom even think to remember they are part of the realm.
Rand shrugged uncomfortably, recalling his surprise when he was told the Two Rivers was part of the realm of Andor. The Queen saw him and smiled ruefully at her daughter.
You see, child.
Elida had put down her knitting, Rand realized, and was studying him. She rose from her stool and slowly came down from the dais to stand before him.
From the Two Rivers, she said.
She reached a hand toward his head. He pulled away from her touch, and she let her hand drop.
With that red in his hair and gray eyes? Two Rivers people are dark of hair and eye, and they seldom have such height.
Her hand darted out to push back his coat sleeve, exposing lighter skin the sun had not reached so often.
Or such skin.
It was an effort not to clench his fists. I was born in Emmons Field, he said stiffly. My mother was an outlander. That's where my eyes come from. My father is Tamal Thor, a shepherd and farmer, as I am. Elida nodded slowly, never taking her eyes from his face. He met her gaze with a levelness that belied the sour feeling in his stomach. He saw her note the steadiness of his look. Still meeting him eye to eye, she moved her hand slowly toward him again. He resolved not to flinch this time. It was his sword she touched, not him, her hand closing around the hilt at the very top. Her fingers tightened, and her eyes opened wide with surprise.
A shepherd from the Two Rivers, she said softly,
a whisper meant to be heard by all.
With a heron-marked sword.
Those last few words acted on the chamber as if she had announced the Dark One. Leather and metal creaked behind Rand, boots scuffling on the marble tiles. From the corner of his eye, he could see Talonvor and another of the guardsmen backing away from him to gain room, hands on their swords, prepared to draw, and, from their faces, prepared to die. In 2 quick strides, Garth Bryn was at the front of the dais between Rand and the Queen. Even Gawain put himself in front of Elaine, a worried look on his face, and a hand on his dagger. Elaine herself looked at him as if she were seeing him for the first time. Morgaze did not change expression, but her hands tightened on the gilded arms of her throne. Only Elida showed less reaction than the Queen. The Aes Sedai gave no sign that she had said anything out of the ordinary. She took her hand from the sword, causing the soldiers to tense even more. Her eyes stayed on his, unruffled and calculating.
Surely, Morgaze said, her voice level, he is too young to have earned a Heronmark blade. He cannot be any older than Gawain.
It belongs with him, Garth Bryn said.
The Queen looked at him in surprise.
How can that be?
I do not know, Morgaze, Bryn said slowly. He is too young. Yet still it belongs with him, and he with it. Look at his eyes. Look how he stands, how the sword fits him, and he it. He is too young, but the sword is his.
When the Captain General fell silent, Elida said,
How did you come by this blade, Randolph Thor, from the Two Rivers?
She said it as if she doubted his name as much as she did where he was from.
My father gave it to me, Rand said. It was his. He thought I'd need a sword out in the world.
Yet another shepherd from the Two Rivers with a heron-marked blade.
Elida's smile made his mouth go dry.
When did you arrive in Camelon?
He had had enough of telling this woman the truth. She made him as afraid as any dark friend had. It was time to start hiding again.
Today, he said, this morning.
Just in time, she murmured. Where are you staying? Don't say you have not found a room somewhere. You look a little tattered, but you have had a chance to freshen.
Where? The Crown and Lion.
He remembered passing the Crown and Lion while looking for the Queen's blessing. It was on the other side of the new city from Master Gil's Inn.
I have a bed there, in the attic.
He had the feeling that she knew he was lying, but she only nodded.
What chance this, she said. Today the unbeliever is brought into Camelon. In 2 days he will be taken north to Tar Valon, and with him goes the daughter heir for her training. And at just this juncture, a young man appears in the palace gardens, claiming to be a loyal subject from the Two Rivers.
I am from the Two Rivers.
They were all looking at him, but all ignored him. All but Talonvor and the guards. Those eyes never blinked.
With a story calculated to entice Elaine, and bearing a heron-marked blade. He does not wear an armband or a cockade to proclaim his allegiance, but wrappings that carefully conceal the heron from inquisitive eyes. What chance this, Morghese?
The queen motioned the captain general to stand aside, and when he did, she studied Rand with a troubled look. It was to Elida that she spoke, though.
What are you naming him? Dark Friend? One of Loghain's followers? The Dark One stirs in Sheogul,
the Aes Sedai replied.
The shadow lies across the pattern, and the future is balanced on the point of a pin. This one is dangerous.
Suddenly Elaine moved, throwing herself onto her knees before the throne.
Mother, I beg you not to harm him. He would have left immediately had I not stopped him. He wanted to go. It was I who made him stay. I cannot believe he is a Dark Friend.
Morghese made a soothing gesture toward her daughter, but her eyes remained on Rand.
Is this a foretelling, Elida? Are you reading the pattern? You say it comes on you when you least expect it and goes as suddenly as it comes. If this is a foretelling, Elida, I command you to speak the truth clearly, without your usual habit of wrapping it in so much mystery that no one can tell if you have said yes or no. Speak. What do you see?
This I foretell,
Elida replied,
and swear under the light that I can say no clearer. From this day Andor marches toward pain and division. The shadow is yet to darken to its blackest, and I cannot see if the light will come after. Where the world has wept one tear, it will weep thousands. This I foretell.
A pall of silence clung to the room, broken only by Morghese expelling her breath as if it were her last. Elida continued to stare into Rand's eyes. She spoke again, barely moving her lips, so softly that he could barely hear her less than an arm's length away.
This, too, I foretell. Pain and division come to the whole world, and this man stands at the heart of it. I obey the queen, she whispered, and speak it clearly.
Rand felt as if his feet had become rooted in the marble floor. The cold and stiffness of the stone crept up his legs and sent a shiver up his spine. No one else could have heard, but she was still looking at him, and he had heard.
I'm a shepherd, he said for the entire room. From the Two Rivers, a shepherd.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills,
Elida said aloud, and he could not tell if there was a touch of mockery in her tone or not.
Lord Garroth, Morghese said, I need the advice of my captain general.
The blocky man shook his head.
Elida Sedai says the lad is dangerous, my queen. And if she could tell more, I would say summon the headsman. But all she says is what any of us can see with our own eyes. There's not a farmer in the countryside won't say things will get worse without any foretelling. Myself, I believe the boy is here through mere happenstance, though an ill one for him. To be safe, my queen, I say clap him in a cell till the Lady Elaine and the Lord Gawain are well on their way. Then let him go. Unless I Sedai, you have more to foretell concerning him.
I have said all that I have read in the pattern, Captain General,
Elida said. She flashed a hard smile at Rand, a smile that barely bent her lips, mocking his inability to say that she was not telling the truth.
A few weeks imprisoned will not harm him, and it may give me a chance to learn more.
Hunger filled her eyes, deepening his chill.
Perhaps another foretelling will come.
For a time Morghese considered, chin on her fist and elbow on the arm of her throne. Rand would have shifted under her frowning gaze if he could have moved at all, but Elida's eyes froze him solid. Finally the queen spoke.
Suspicion is smothering Camelin. Perhaps all of Andor. Fear and black suspicion.
Women denounce their neighbors for dark friends. Men scroll the dragon's fang on the doors of people they have known for years. I will not become part of it.
Morghese, Elida began, but the queen cut her off.
I will not become part of it. When I took the throne, I swore to uphold justice for the high and the low, and I will uphold it, even if I am the last in Andor to remember justice. Randolph Thor, do you swear under the light that your father, a shepherd in the Two Rivers, gave you this Heronmark blade?
Rand worked his mouth to get enough moisture to speak.
I do.
Abruptly remembering to whom he was speaking, he hastily added,
My queen.
Lord Garth raised a heavy eyebrow, but Morghese did not seem to mind.
And you climbed the garden wall simply to gain a look at the false dragon?
Yes, my queen.
Do you mean harm to the throne of Andor, or to my daughter, or my son?
Her tone said the last two would gain him even shorter shrift than the first.
I mean no harm to anyone, my queen. To you and yours, least of all. I will give you justice, then, Randolph Thor, she said. First, because I have the advantage of Elida and Garth in having heard Two Rivers' speech when I was young. You have not the look, but if a dim memory can serve me, you have the Two Rivers on your tongue. Second, no one with your hair and eyes would claim that he is a Two Rivers shepherd unless it was true. And that your father gave you a Heronmark blade is too preposterous to be a lie. And third, the voice that whispers to me that the best lie is often one too ridiculous to be taken for a lie, that voice is not proof. I will uphold the laws I have made. I give you your freedom, Randolph Thor, but I suggest you take a care where you trespass in the future. If you are found on the palace grounds again, it will not go so easily with you.
Thank you, my queen, he said hoarsely.
He could feel Elida's displeasure like a heat on his face.
Talonvor, Morghese said, escort this. Escort my daughter's guest from the palace and show him every courtesy. The rest of you go as well. No, Elida, you stay. And if you will too, please, Lord Garth, I must decide what to do about these white cloaks in the city.
Talonvor and the guardsmen sheathed their swords reluctantly, ready to draw again in an instant. Still, Rand was glad to let the soldiers form a hollow box around him and to follow Talonvor. Elida was only half attending what the queen was saying. He could feel her eyes on his back. What would have happened if Morghese had not kept the Aes Sedai with her? The thought made him wish the soldiers would walk faster. To his surprise, Elaine and Gawain exchanged a few words outside the door, then fell in beside him. Talonvor was surprised, too. The young officer looked from them back to the doors closing now.
My mother, Elaine said, ordered him to be escorted from the palace, Talonvor, with every courtesy. What are you waiting for?
Talonvor scowled at the doors behind which the queen was conferring with her advisers.
Nothing, milady, he said sourly,
and needlessly ordered the escort forward. The wonders of the palace slid by Rand unseen. He was befuddled, snatches of thought spinning by too fast to grasp.
You have not the look. This man stands at the heart of it.
The escort stopped. He blinked, startled to find himself in the great court at the front of the palace, standing at the tall gilded gates, gleaming in the sun. Those gates would not be opened for a single man, certainly not for a trespasser, even if the daughter heir did claim guest right for him. Wordlessly, Talonvor unbarred a sally port, a small door set within one gate.
It is the custom, Elaine said, to escort guests as far as the gates, but not to watch them go. It is the pleasure of a guest's company that should be remembered, not the sadness of parting.
Thank you, my lady, Rand said.
He touched the scarf bandaging his head.
For everything.
Custom in the Two Rivers is for a guest to bring a small gift. I am afraid I have nothing. Although, he added dryly, apparently I did teach you something of the Two Rivers folk.
If I had told Mother, I think you are handsome, she certainly would have had you locked in a cell.
Elaine favored him with a dazzling smile.
Fare you well, Randolph Thor.
Gaping, he watched her go, a younger version of Morghese's beauty and majesty.
"Do not try to bandy words with her," Gawain laughed. "She will win every time."
Rand nodded absently.
"Handsome? Light, the daughter heir to the throne of Andor."
He gave himself a shake to clear his head. Gawain seemed to be waiting for something. Rand looked at him for a moment.
"My lord, when I told you I was from the Two Rivers, you were surprised. And everybody else, your mother, Lord Garth, Elida Sedai."
A shiver ran down his back.
"None of them..."
He could not finish. He was not even sure why he started.
"I am Tam Althor's son, even if I was not born in the Two Rivers."
Gawain nodded, as if it was for this he had been waiting. Still, he hesitated. Rand opened his mouth to take back the unspoken question, and Gawain said,
"Wrap a shufa around your head, Rand, and you would be the image of an Aiel man. Odd, since Mother seems to think you sound like a Two Rivers man, at least. I wish we could have come to know one another, Randall Thor. Fare you well."
An Aiel man. Rand stood watching Gawain's retreating back until an impatient cough from Talonvor reminded him where he was. He ducked through the sally port, barely clearing his heels before Talonvor slammed it behind him. The bars inside were jammed into place loudly. The oval plaza in front of the palace was empty now. All the soldiers gone, all the crowds, trumpets, and drums vanished in silence. Nothing left but a scattering of litter blowing across the pavement and a few people hurrying about their business now that the excitement was done. He could not make out if they showed the red or the white.
A human.
With a start, he realized he was standing right in front of the palace gates, right where Elida could find him easily once she finished with the queen. Pulling his cloak close, he broke into a trot, across the plaza, and into the streets of the inner city. He looked back frequently to see if anyone was following him, but the sweeping curves kept him from seeing very far. He could remember Elida's eyes all too well, though, and imagine them watching. By the time he reached the gates to the new city, he was running. Chapter 41. Old Friends and New Threats. Back at the Queen's Blessing, Rand threw himself against the front doorframe, panting. He had run all the way, not caring if anyone saw that he wore the red, or even if they took his running as an excuse to chase him. He did not even think a fade could have caught him. Lamgren was sitting on a bench by the door, a brindled cat in his arms, when he came running up. The man stood to look for trouble the way Rand had come, still calmly scratching behind the cat's ears. Seeing nothing, he sat back down again, careful not to disturb the animal.
"Fools tried to steal some of the cats a while back," he said.
He examined his knuckles before going back to his scratching.
"Good money in cats these days."
The two men showing the white were still across the way, Rand saw, one with a black eye and a swollen jaw. That one wore a sour scowl and rubbed his sword hilt with a sullen eagerness as he watched the inn.
"Where's Master Gil?" Rand asked.
"Library,"
Lamgwin replied. The cat began purring, and he grinned.
"Nothing bothers a cat for long, not even somebody trying to stick him in a sack."
Rand hurried inside, through the common room, now with its usual complement of men wearing the red and talking over their ale. About the false dragon, and whether the white cloaks would make trouble when he was taken north. No one cared what happened to Loghain, but they all knew the daughter heir and Lord Gawain would be traveling in the party, and no man there would countenance any risk to them. He found Master Gil in the library, playing stones with Loyal. A plump tabby sat on the table, feet tucked under her, watching their hands move over the cross-hatched board. The ogier placed another stone with a touch oddly delicate for his fingers. Shaking his head, Master Gil took the excuse of Rand's appearance to turn from the table. Loyal almost always wanted stones.
"I was beginning to worry where you were, lad. Thought you might have had trouble with some of those white-flashing traitors, or run into that beggar or something."
For a minute, Rand stood there with his mouth open. He had forgotten all about that bundle of rags of a man.
"I saw him," he said finally. "But that's nothing. I saw the Queen, too, and Elida. That's where the trouble is."
Master Gil snorted a laugh.
"The Queen, eh? You don't say."
We had Gareth Bryn out in the common room an hour or so ago, arm-wrestling the Lord Captain Commander of the Children. But the Queen now, that's something.
Blood and ashes, Rand growled. Everybody thinks I'm lying today.
He tossed his cloak across the back of a chair and threw himself onto another. He was too wound up to sit back. He perched on the front edge, mopping his face with a handkerchief.
I saw the beggar and he saw me, and I thought, that's not important. I climbed up on a wall around a garden where I could see the plaza in front of the palace, where they took Loghain in. And I fell off on the inside.
I almost believe you aren't making fun, the innkeeper said slowly.
Tavirin, Loyal murmured.
Oh, it happened, Rand said. Light help me, it did.
Master Gil's skepticism melted slowly as he went on, turning to quiet alarm. The innkeeper leaned more and more forward until he was perched on the edge of his chair, the same as Rand was. Loyal listened impassively, except that every so often he rubbed his broad nose and the tufts on his ears gave a little twitch. Rand told everything that had happened, everything except what Elida had whispered to him, and what Gowan had said at the palace gate. One he did not want to think about, the other had nothing to do with anything.
I'm Tamall Thor's son, even if I wasn't born in the Two Rivers. I am. I'm Two Rivers' blood, and Tam is my father.
Abruptly he realized he had stopped talking, caught up in his thoughts, and they were looking at him. For one panicky moment, he wondered if he had said too much.
Well, Master Gil said, there's no more waiting for your friends for you. You will have to leave the city, and fast. 2 days at the most. Can you get Matt on his feet in that time, or should I send for Mother Grubb?
Rand gave him a perplexed look.
2 days?
Elida is Queen Morgaze's advisor, right next to Captain General Gareth Bryn himself. Maybe ahead of him. If she sets the Queen's guards looking for you, Lord Gareth won't stop her unless she interferes with their other duties. Well, the guards can search every inn in Camelin in 2 days. And that's saying some ill chance doesn't bring them here the first day or the first hour. Maybe there's a little time if they start over at the Crown and Lion, but none for dawdling.
Rand nodded slowly.
If I can't get Matt out of bed, you send for Mother Grubb. I have a little money left, maybe enough.
I'll take care of Mother Grubb, the innkeeper said gruffly. And I suppose I can lend you a couple of horses. You try walking to Tar Valon, and you'll wear through what's left of your boots halfway there.
You're a good friend, Rand said. It seems like we've brought you nothing but trouble, but you're still willing to help. A good friend.
Master Gil seemed embarrassed. He shrugged his shoulders and cleared his throat and looked down. That brought his eyes to the stones board, and he jerked them away again. Loyal was definitely winning.
Tom's always been a good friend to me. If he's willing to go out of his way for you, I can do a little bit, too.
I would like to go with you when you leave, Rand,
Loyal said suddenly.
I thought that was settled, Loyal.
He hesitated. Master Gil still did not know the whole of the danger, then added,
You know what waits for Matt and me, what's chasing us.
Dark friends, the Ogier replied in a placid rumble. And Aes Sedai, and the Light knows what else. Or the Dark One. You are going to Tar Valon, and there is a very fine grove there, which I have heard the Aes Sedai tend well. In any case, there is more to see in the world than the groves. You truly are Tavirin, Rand. The pattern weaves itself around you, and you stand in the heart of it.
This man stands at the heart of it.
Rand felt a chill.
I don't stand at the heart of anything, he said harshly.
Master Gil blinked, and even Loyal seemed taken aback at his anger. The innkeeper and the Ogier looked at each other, and then at the floor. Rand forced his expression smooth, drawing deep breaths. For a wonder, he found the void that had eluded him so often of late, and calmness. They did not deserve his anger.
You can come, Loyal, he said. I don't know why you would want to, but I'd be grateful for the company. You know how Matt is.
I know, Loyal said.
I still cannot go into the streets without raising a mob shouting Trolloc after me. But Matt, at least, only uses words. He has not tried to kill me.
Of course not, Rand said. Not Matt. He wouldn't go that far. Not Matt.
A tap came at the door, and one of the serving maids, Gilda, stuck her head into the room. Her mouth was tight, and her eyes worried.
Master Gil, come quickly, please. There's white cloaks in the common room.
Master Gil leaped up with an oath, sending the cat jumping from the table to stalk out of the room, tail stiff and offended.
I'll come. Run, tell them I'm coming. Then stay out of their way. You hear me, girl? Keep away from them.
Gilda bobbed her head and vanished.
You had best stay here, he told Loyal.
The Ogier snorted, a sound like sheets ripping.
I have no desire for any more meetings with the Children of the Light.
Master Gil's eye fell on the stones board, and his mood seemed to lighten.
It looks as if we'll have to start the game over later.
No need for that.
Loyal stretched an arm to the shelves and took down a book. His hands dwarfed the cloth-bound volume.
We can take up from where the board lies. It is your turn.
Master Gil grimaced.
If it isn't one thing, it's another, he muttered as he hurried from the room.
Rand followed him, but slowly. He had no more desire than Loyal to become involved with the children.
This man stands at the heart of it.
He stopped at the door to the common room, where he could see what went on, but far enough back that he hoped he would not be noticed. Dead silence filled the room. Five white cloaks stood in the middle of the floor, studiously being ignored by the folk at the tables. One of them had the silver lightning flash of an under-officer beneath the sunburst on his cloak. Lamgwin was lounging against the wall by the door, intently cleaning his fingernails with a splinter. Four more of the guards Master Gil had hired were spaced across the wall from him, all industriously paying no attention at all to the white cloaks. If the Children of the Light noticed anything, they gave no sign. Only the under-officer showed any emotion at all, impatiently tapping his steel-backed gauntlets against his palm as he waited for the innkeeper. Master Gil crossed the room to him quickly, a cautiously neutral look on his face.
"The light illumine you," he said with a careful bow,
not too deep, but not slight enough to actually be insulting either.
"And our good Queen Morghese. How may I help?"
"I've no time for your drivel, innkeeper," the under-officer snapped. "I have been to 20 inns already today, each a worse pigsty than the last, and I'll see 20 more before the sun sets. I'm looking for Dark Friends, a boy from the Two Rivers."
Master Gil's face grew darker with every word. He puffed up as if he would explode, and finally he did, cutting the white cloak off in turn.
"There are no Dark Friends in my establishment. Every man here is a good Queen's man." "Yes, and we all know where Morghese stands," the under-officer twisted the Queen's name into a sneer. "And her Tarvalin witch, don't we?"
The scrape of chair legs was loud. Suddenly every man in the room was on his feet. They stood still as statues, but everyone staring grimly at the white cloaks. The under-officer did not appear to notice, but the four behind him looked around uneasily.
"It will go easier with you, innkeeper," the under-officer said, "if you cooperate. The temper of the times goes hard with those who shelter Dark Friends. I wouldn't think an inn with the dragon's fang on its door would get much custom. Might have trouble with fire with that on your door."
"You get out of here now," Master Gil said quietly, "or I'll send for the Queen's guards to cart what's left of you to the middens."
Lamgwin's sword rasped out of its sheath, and the coarse scrape of steel on leather was repeated throughout the room as swords and daggers filled hands. Serving maids scurried for the doors. The under-officer looked around in scornful disbelief.
"The dragon's fang
won't help you five,"
Master Gil finished for him. He held up a clenched fist and raised his forefinger.
"One."
"You must be mad, innkeeper, threatening the Children of the Light.
White cloaks hold no writ in Camelin. Two.
Can you really believe this will end here?
Three.
We'll be back,"
the under-officer snapped, and then he was hastily turning his men around, trying to pretend he was leaving in good order and in his own time. He was hampered in this by the eagerness his men showed for the door, not running, but not making secret that they wanted to be outside. Lamgwen stood across the door with his sword, only giving way in response to Master Gil's frantic waves. When the white cloaks were gone, the innkeeper dropped heavily onto a chair. He rubbed a hand across his forehead, then stared at it as if surprised that it was not covered with sweat. All over the room, men seated themselves again, laughing over what they had done. Some went over to clap Master Gil on the shoulder. When he saw Rand, the innkeeper tottered off the chair and over to him.
"Who would have thought I had it in me to be a hero?"
he said wonderingly.
"The light illumined me."
Abruptly he gave himself a shake, and his voice regained almost its normal tone.
"You'll have to stay out of sight until I can get you out of the city."
With a careful look back into the common room, he pushed Rand deeper into the hall.
"That lot will be back, or else a few spies wearing red for the day." After that little show I put on, I'll doubt they'll care whether you're here or not. But they'll act as though you are."
"That's crazy," Rand protested.
At the innkeeper's gesture, he lowered his voice.
"The white cloaks don't have any reason to be after me."
"I don't know about reasons, lad. But they're after you and Matt for certain sure. What have you been up to? Elida and the white cloaks?"
Rand raised his hands in protest, then let them fall. It made no sense, but he had heard the White Cloak.
"What about you? The White Cloaks will make trouble for you, even when they don't find us."
"No worries about that, lad. The Queen's guards still uphold the law, even if they do let traitors strut around showing white. As for the night, well, Lamgwin and his friends might not get much sleep, but I could almost pity anybody who tries to put a mark on my door."
Gilda appeared beside them, dropping a curtsy to Master Gil.
"Sir, there's a lady in the kitchens."
She sounded scandalized at the combination.
"She's asking for Master Rand, sir, and Master Matt, by name."
Rand exchanged a puzzled look with the innkeeper.
"Lad," Master Gil said, "if you've actually managed to bring the Lady Elaine down from the palace to my inn, we'll all end up facing the headsman."
Gilda squeaked at the mention of the daughter heir and gave Rand a round-eyed stare.
"Off with you, girl," the innkeeper said sharply, "and keep quiet about what you've heard. It's nobody's business."
Gilda bobbed again and darted down the hallway, flashing glances over her shoulder at Rand as she went.
"In 5 minutes," Master Gil sighed, "she will be telling the other women you're a prince in disguise. By nightfall, it will be all over the new city."
"Master Gil," Rand said, "I never mentioned Matt to Elaine. It can't be."
Suddenly a huge smile lit up his face, and he ran for the kitchens.
"Wait!" the innkeeper called behind him. "Wait until you know! Wait, you fool!"
Rand threw open the door to the kitchens, and there they were. Moraine rested her serene eyes on him, unsurprised. Nynaeve and Egwene ran laughing to throw their arms around him, with Perrin crowding in behind them, all three patting his shoulders as if they had to be convinced that he was really there. In the doorway, leading to the stable yard, Lan lounged with one boot up on the doorframe, dividing his attention between the kitchen and the yard outside. Rand tried to hug the two women and shake Perrin's hand, all at the same time, and it was a tangle of arms and laughter, complicated by Nynaeve trying to feel his face for fever. They looked somewhat the worse for wear, bruises on Perrin's face, and he had a way of keeping his eyes downcast that he had never had before, but they were alive and together again. His throat was so tight he could barely talk.
"I was afraid I'd never see you again," he managed finally. "I was afraid you were all..." "I knew you were alive,"
Egwene said against his chest.
"I always knew it. Always."
"I did not," Nynaeve said. Her voice was sharp for just that moment, but it softened in the next, and she smiled up at him.
"You look well, Rand. Not overfed by any means, but well, thank the light."
"Well," Master Gil said behind him, "I guess you know these people after all. Those friends you were looking for?"
Rand nodded.
"Yes, my friends."
He made introductions all around. It still felt odd to be giving Lan and Moraine their right names. They both eyed him sharply when he did. The innkeeper greeted everyone with an open smile, but he was properly impressed at meeting a warder, and especially at Moraine. At her, he gaped openly. It was one thing knowing an Aes Sedai had been helping the boys, quite something else having her appear in the kitchen. Then bowed deeply.
"You are welcome to the Queen's blessing, Aes Sedai, as my guest. though I suppose you'll be staying at the palace with the Lyda Sedai, and the Aes Sedai who came with the false dragon.
Bowing again, he gave Rand a quick, worried look. It was all very well to say he did not speak ill of Aes Sedai, but that was not the same as saying he wanted one sleeping under his roof. Rand nodded encouragingly, trying to tell him silently that it was all right. Moraine was not like Elida, with a threat hidden behind every glance, under every word.
Are you sure? Even now, are you sure? I believe I will stay here, Moraine said, for the short time I remain in Camelin, and you must allow me to pay.
A calico cat sauntered in from the hallway to strop the innkeeper's ankles. No sooner had the calico begun than a fuzzy gray sprang from under the table, arching its back and hissing. The calico crouched with a threatening growl, and the gray streaked past Lan into the stable yard. Master Gil began apologizing for the cats at the same time he protested that Moraine would honor him by being his guest, and was she sure she would not prefer the palace, which he would quite understand, but he hoped she would accept his best room as a gift. It made a jumble to which Moraine seemed to pay no attention at all. Instead, she bent down to scratch the orange and white cat. It promptly left Master Gil's ankles for hers.
"I've seen four other cats here so far," she said. "You have a problem with mice?
Rats?"
"Rats, Moraine Sedai,"
the innkeeper sighed.
"A terrible problem. Not that I don't keep a clean place, you understand. It's all the people. The whole city is full of people and rats. But my cats take care of it. You'll not be troubled, I promise."
Rand exchanged a fleeting look with Perrin, who put his eyes down again right away. There was something odd about Perrin's eyes, and he was so silent. Perrin was almost always slow to speak, but now he was saying nothing at all.
"It could be all the people," he said.
"With your permission, Master Gil," Moraine said, as if she took it for granted.
"It is a simple matter to keep rats away from this street. With luck, the rats will not even realize they are being kept away."
Master Gil frowned at that last, but he bowed, accepting her offer.
"If you are sure you don't want to stay at the palace," I said, "I..."
"Where is Matt?"
Nynaeve said suddenly.
"She said he was here too." "Upstairs," Rand said. "He's not feeling well."
Nynaeve's head came up.
"He's sick? I'll leave the rats to her, and I'll attend to him. Take me to join him now, Rand."
"All of you go up," Moraine said. "I will join you in a few minutes. We are crowding Master Gil's kitchen, and it would be best if we could all be somewhere quiet for a time." There was an undercurrent in her voice. "Stay out of sight. The hiding is not done yet."
"Come on," Rand said. "We'll go up the back way."
The Emmonsfield folk crowded after him to the back staircase, leaving the Aes Sedai and the warder in the kitchen with Master Gil. He could not get over being back together. It was nearly as if he were home again. He could not stop grinning. The same relief, almost joyous, seemed to be affecting the others. They chuckled to themselves and kept reaching out to grip his arm. Perrin's voice seemed subdued, and he still kept his head down, but he began to talk as they climbed.
"Moraine said she could find you and Matt, and she did. When we rode into the city, the rest of us couldn't stop staring. Well, all except Lan, of course. All the people, the buildings, everything."
His thick curls swung as he shook his head in disbelief.
"It's all so big, and so many people. Some of them kept staring at us, too, shouting, 'Red or white,' like it made some kind of sense."
Egwene touched Rand's sword, fingering the red wrappings.
"What does it mean?"
"Nothing," he said. "Nothing important. We're leaving for Tarvalen, remember?" Egwene gave him a look, but she removed her hand from the sword and took up where Perrin had left off.
"Moraine didn't look at anything any more than Lan did. She led us back and forth through all those streets so many times, like a dog hunting a scent, that I thought you couldn't be here. Then, all of a sudden, she took off down a street, and the next thing I knew, we were handing the horses to the stableman and marching into the kitchen. She never even asked if you were here. Just told a woman who was mixing batter to go tell Randall Thor and Matt Cawthon that someone wanted to see them. And there you were,"
she grinned,
"like a ball popping into the gleeman's hand out of nowhere."
"Where is the gleeman?" Perrin asked. "Is he with you?" Rand's stomach lurched, and the good feeling of having friends around him dimmed.
Tom's dead. I think he's dead. There was a fade.
He could not say any more. Nynaeve shook her head, muttering under her breath. The silence thickened around them, stifling the little chuckles, flattening the joy until they reached the head of the stairs.
"Matt's not sick, exactly," he said then. "It's... you'll see."
He flung open the door to the room he shared with Matt.
"Look who's here, Matt."
Matt was still curled up in a ball on the bed just as Rand had left him. He raised his head to stare at them.
"How do you know they're really who they look like?"
he said hoarsely. His face was flushed, the skin tight and slick with sweat.
"How do I know you're who you look like?"
"Not sick."
Nynaeve gave Rand a disdainful look as she pushed past him, already unslinging her bag from her shoulder.
"Everybody changes," Matt rasped. "How can I be sure? Perrin, is that you? You've changed, haven't you?"
His laugh sounded more like a cough.
"Oh, yes, you've changed."
To Rand's surprise, Perrin dropped onto the edge of the other bed with his head in his hands, staring at the floor. Matt's hacking laughter seemed to pierce him. Nynaeve knelt beside Matt's bed and put a hand to his face, pushing up his headcloth. He jerked back from her with a scornful look. His eyes were bright and glazed.
"You're burning," she said. "But you should not be sweating with this much fever."
She could not keep the worry out of her voice.
"Rand, you and Perrin fetch some clean cloths, and as much cool water as you can carry. I'll bring your temperature down first, Matt, and..." "Pretty Nynaeve," Matt spat. "A wisdom isn't supposed to think of herself as a woman, is she? Not a pretty woman, but you do, don't you? Now. You can't make yourself forget that you're a pretty woman now, and it frightens you. Everybody changes."
Nynaeve's face paled as he spoke. Whether with anger or something else, Rand could not tell. Matt gave a sly laugh, and his feverish eyes slid to Egwene.
"Pretty Egwene," he croaked. "Pretty as Nynaeve. And you share other things now, don't you? Other dreams. What do you dream about now?"
Egwene took a step back from the bed.
"We are safe from the Dark One's eyes for the time being," Moraine announced as she walked into the room with Lan at her heels.
Her eyes fell on Matt as she stepped through the doorway, and she hissed as if she had touched a hot stove.
"Get away from him!"
Nynaeve did not move except for turning to stare at the Aes Sedai in surprise. In two quick steps, Moraine seized the wisdom by the shoulders, hauling her across the floor like a sack of grain. Nynaeve struggled and protested, but Moraine did not release her until she was well away from the bed. The wisdom continued her protests as she got to her feet, angrily straightening her clothes, but Moraine ignored her completely. The Aes Sedai watched Matt to the exclusion of everything else, eyeing him the way she would a viper.
"All of you stay away from him," she said, "and be quiet."
Matt stared back as intently as she. He bared his teeth in a silent, snarling rictus and pulled himself into an even tighter knot, but he never took his eyes from hers. Slowly she put one hand on him, lightly, on a knee drawn up to his chest. A convulsion shook him at her touch, a shudder of revulsion spasming through his entire body. And abruptly he pulled one hand out, slashing at her face with the ruby-hilted dagger. 1 minute Lan was in the doorway, and the next he was at the bedside, as if he had not bothered with the intervening space. His hand caught Matt's wrist, stopping the slash, as if it had struck stone. Still Matt held himself in that tight ball. Only the hand with the dagger tried to move, straining against the warder's implacable grip. Matt's eyes never left Moraine, and they burned with hate. Moraine also did not move. She did not flinch from the blade, only inches from her face, as she had not when he first struck.
"How did he come by this?" she asked in a steel voice. "I asked if Mordith had given you anything. I asked, and I warned you, and you said he had not."
"He didn't," Rand said. "He...
Matt took it from the treasure room."
Moraine looked at him, her eyes seeming to burn as much as Matt's. He almost stepped back before she turned away again, back to the bed.
"I didn't know until after we were separated. I didn't know."
"You did not know."
Moraine studied Matt. He still lay with his knees pulled up to his chest, still snarled soundlessly at her, and his hand yet fought land to reach her with a dagger.
"It is a wonder you got this far carrying this. I felt the evil of it when I laid eyes on him. The touch of Mushadar. But a Fade could sense it for miles. Even though he would not know exactly where, he would know it was near. And Mushadar would draw his spirit while his bones remembered that this same evil swallowed an army. Dreadlords, Fades, Trollocs, and all. Some dark friends could probably feel it too. Those who have truly given away their souls. There could not help but be those who would wonder at suddenly feeling this, as if the very air around them itched. They would be compelled to seek it. It should have drawn them to it as a magnet draws iron filings. There were dark friends, Rand said, more than once, but we got away from them. And a Fade, the night before we reached Camelin, but he never saw us.
He cleared his throat.
There were rumors of strange things in the night outside the city. It could be Trollocs.
Oh, it's Trollocs, sheepherder, Bland said wryly. And where Trollocs are, there are Fades.
Tendons stood out on the back of his hand from the effort of holding Matt's wrist, but there was no strain in his voice.
They've tried to hide their passage, but I have seen sign for 2 days. And heard farmers and villagers mutter about things in the night. The Murdral managed to strike into the Two Rivers unseen somehow, but every day they come closer to those who can send soldiers to hunt them down. Even so, they won't stop now, sheepherder.
But we're in Camelin, Egwene said. They can't get to us as long as...
They can't, the warder cut her off. The Fades are building their numbers in the countryside. That's plain enough from the sign, if you know what to look for. Already there are more Trollocs than they need to just watch all the ways out of the city. 12 fists, at least. There can only be one reason. When the Fades have enough numbers, they will come into the city after you. That act may send half the armies of the South marching to the borderlands, but the evidence is that they're willing to take that risk. You three have escaped them too long. It looks as if you've brought a new Trolloc war to Camelin, sheepherder.
Egwene gave a gasping sob, and Perrin shook his head as though to deny it. Rand felt a sickness in his stomach at the thought of Trollocs in the streets of Camelin. All those people at one another's throats, never realizing the real threat, waiting to come over the walls. What would they do when they suddenly found Trollocs and Fades in their midst, killing them? He could see the towers burning, flames breaking through the domes, Trollocs pillaging through the curving streets and vistas of the inner city, the palace itself in flames, Elaine and Gowan and Morghese, dead.
Not yet, Moraine said absently.
She was still intent on Matt.
If we can find a way out of Camelin, the half-men will have no more interest here. If. So many ifs.
Better we were all dead, Perrin said suddenly, and Rand jumped at the echo of his own thoughts.
Perrin still sat staring at the floor, glaring at it now, and his voice was bitter.
Everywhere we go, we bring pain and suffering on our backs. It would be better for everyone if we were dead.
Nynaeve rounded on him, her face half fury and half worried fear. But Moraine forestalled her.
What do you think to gain, for yourself or anyone else, by dying?
The Aes Sedai asked. Her voice was level, yet sharp.
If the Lord of the Grave has gained as much freedom to touch the pattern as I fear, he can reach you dead more easily than alive now. Dead, you can help no one. Not the people who have helped you, not your friends and family back in the Two Rivers. The shadow is falling over the world, and none of you can stop it dead.
Perrin raised his head to look at her, and Rand gave a start. The irises of his friend's eyes were more yellow than brown. With his shaggy hair and the intensity of his gaze, there was something about him. Rand could not grasp it enough to make it out. Perrin spoke with a soft flatness that gave his words more weight than if he had shouted.
We can't stop it alive either, now can we? I will have time to argue with you later, Moraine said, but your friend needs me now.
She stepped aside so they could all see Matt clearly. His eyes still on her with a rage-filled stare, he had not moved or changed his position on the bed. Sweat stood out on his face, and his lips were bloodless in an unchanging snarl.
All of his strength seemed to be pouring into the effort to reach Moraine with the dagger Lan held motionless.
Or had you forgotten?
Perrin gave an embarrassed shrug and spread his hands wordlessly.
What's wrong with him?
Egwene asked, and Nynaeve added,
Is it catching? I can still treat him. I don't seem to catch sick, no matter what it is.
Oh, it is catching, Moraine said, and your protection would not save you. She pointed to the ruby-hilted dagger, careful not to let her finger touch it. The blade trembled as Matt strained to reach her with it.
This is from Shaddaa Logoth. There is not a pebble of that city that is not tainted and dangerous to bring outside the walls. And this is far more than a pebble. The evil that killed Shaddaa Logoth is in it, and in Matt, too, now.
Suspicion and hatred so strong that even those closest are seen as enemies, rooted so deep in the bone that eventually the only thought left is to kill. By carrying the dagger beyond the walls of Shaddaa Logoth, he freed it, this seed of it, from what bound it to that place. It will have waxed and waned in him, what he is in the heart of him, fighting what the contagion of Mashadar sought to make him. But now the battle inside him is almost done, and he almost defeated. Soon, if it does not kill him first, he will spread that evil like a plague wherever he goes. Just as one scratch from that blade is enough to infect and destroy, so soon a few minutes with Matt will be just as deadly.
Nynaeve's face had gone white.
Can you do anything? She whispered.
I hope so, Moraine sighed. For the sake of the world, I hope I am not too late.
Her hand delved into the pouch at her belt and came out with a silk-shrouded angrial.
Leave me. Stay together and find somewhere you will not be seen. But leave me. I will do what I can for him.
Chapter 42 Remembrance of Dreams. It was a subdued group that Rand led back down the stairs. None of them wanted to talk to him now, or to one another. He did not feel much like talking either. The sun was far enough across the sky to dim the back stairwell, but the lamps had not yet been lit. Sunlight and shadow striped the stairs. Perrin's face was as closed as the others, but where worry creased everyone else's brow, his was smooth. Rand thought the look Perrin wore was resignation. He wondered why and wanted to ask, but whenever Perrin walked through a deeper patch of shadow, his eyes seemed to gather in what little light there was, glowing softly like polished amber. Rand shivered and tried to concentrate on his surroundings, on the walnut-paneled walls and the oak stair railing, on sturdy, everyday things. He wiped his hands on his coat several times, but each time sweat sprang out in his palms anew.
It'll all be all right now. We're together again, and... Light, Matt.
He took them to the library by the back way that went by the kitchens, avoiding the common room. Not many travelers used the library. Most of those who could read stayed at more elegant inns in the inner city. Master Gill kept it more for his own enjoyment than for the handful of patrons who wanted a book now and then. Rand did not want to think why Moraine wanted to keep them out of sight, but he kept remembering the white cloak under-officer saying he would be back, and Elida's eyes when she asked where he was staying. Those were reasons enough, whatever Moraine wanted. He took 5 steps into the library before he realized that everyone else had stopped, crowded together in the doorway, open-mouthed and goggling. A brisk blaze crackled in the fireplace, and Loyal was sprawled in the long couch, reading, a small black cat with white feet, curled and half asleep on his stomach. When they entered, he closed the book with a huge finger marking his place, and gently set the cat on the floor, then stood to bow formally. Rand was so used to the Ogier that it took him a minute to realize that Loyal was the object of the other's stares.
"These are the friends I was waiting for, Loyal," he said. "This is Nynaeve, the wisdom of my village, and Perrin, and this is Egwene."
"Ah, yes," Loyal boomed. "Egwene. Rand has spoken of you a great deal. Yes, I am Loyal."
"He's an Ogier," Rand explained, and watched their amazement change in kind.
Even after Trollocs and Fades in the flesh, it was still astonishing to meet a legend walking and breathing. Remembering his own first reaction to Loyal, he grinned ruefully.
They were doing better than he had. Loyal took their gaping in his stride. Rand supposed he hardly noticed it compared with a mob shouting Trolloc.
"And the Aes Sedai, Rand?"
Loyal asked. "Upstairs with Matt." The Ogier raised one bushy eyebrow thoughtfully.
"Then he is ill. I suggest we all be seated. She will be joining us, yes? There's nothing to do but wait."
The act of sitting seemed to loosen some catch inside the Emmonsfield folk, as if being in a well-stuffed chair with a fire in the fireplace and a cat now curled up on the hearth made them feel at home. As soon as they were settled, they excitedly began asking the Ogier questions. To Rand's surprise, Perrin was the first to speak. "The Steading, Loyal. Are they really havens, the way the stories say?" His voice was intent, as if he had a particular reason for asking. Loyal was glad to tell about the Steading, and how he came to be at the Queen's blessing, and what he had seen in his travels. Rand soon leaned back, only partly listening. He had heard it all before, in detail. Loyal liked to talk, and talk at length when he had the slightest chance, though he usually seemed to think a story needed 200 or 300 years of background to make it understood. His sense of time was very strange. To him, 300 years seemed a reasonable length of time for a story or explanation to cover. He always talked about leaving the Steading as if it were just a few months before, but it had finally come out that he had been gone more than 3 years. Rand's thoughts drifted to Matt. A dagger. A bloody knife, and it might kill him just from carrying it. Light, I don't want any more adventure. If she can heal him, we should all go... not home. Can't go home. Somewhere. We'll all go somewhere they've never heard of Aes Sedai or the Dark One. Somewhere. The door opened, and for a moment, Rand thought he was still imagining. Matt stood there blinking, with his coat buttoned up and a dark scarf wrapped low around his forehead. Then Rand saw Moraine, with her hand on Matt's shoulder, and Lan behind them. The Aes Sedai was watching Matt carefully, as one watches someone only lately out of a sickbed. As always, Lan was watching everything while appearing to watch nothing. Matt looked as if he had never been sick a day. His first hesitant smile included everyone, though it slipped into an open-mouthed stare at the sight of Loyal, as if he were seeing the Ogier for the first time. With a shrug and a shake, he turned his attention back to his friends. He took a deep breath. It seems I've been acting, sort of oddly. I don't remember much of it, really. He gave Moraine an uneasy look. She smiled back confidently, and he went on. Everything is hazy after Whitebridge. Tom and the... He shivered and hurried on. The further from Whitebridge, the hazier it gets. I don't really remember arriving in Camerun at all.
He eyed Loyal askance.
Not really. Moraine Sedai says I... Upstairs, I...
He grinned, and suddenly he truly was the old Matt.
You can't hold a man to blame for what he does when he's crazy, can you?
You always were crazy, Perrin said, and for a moment he too sounded as of old.
No,
Nynaeve said. Tears made her eyes bright, but she was smiling.
None of us blames you.
Rand and Egwene began talking at once then, telling Matt how happy they were to see him well, and how well he looked, with a few laughing comments thrown in about hoping that he was done with tricks now that one so ugly had been played on him. Matt met banter with banter as he found a chair with all of his old swagger. As he sat down, still grinning, he absent-mindedly touched his coat as if to make sure that something tucked behind his belt was still there, and Rand's breath caught.
Yes, Moraine said quietly, he still has the dagger.
The laughter and talk was still going on among the rest of the Emmonsfield folk, but she had noticed his sudden intake of breath and had seen what had caused it. She moved closer to his chair, where she did not have to raise her voice for him to hear clearly.
I cannot take it away from him without killing him. The binding has lasted too long and grown too strong. That must be a knotted in Tarvalin. It is beyond me, or any lone Aes Sedai, even with an Angreal. But he doesn't look sick anymore.
He had a thought and looked up at her.
As long as he has the dagger, the Fades will know where we are. Dark friends, too, some of them. You said so.
I have contained that, after a fashion. If they come close enough to sense it now, they will be on top of us anyway. I cleansed the taint from him, Rand, and did what I could to slow its return. But return it will, in time, unless he receives help in Tarvalin.
A good thing that's where we're going, isn't it?
He thought maybe it was the resignation in his voice and the hope for something else that made her give him a sharp look before turning away. Loyal was on his feet, bowing to her.
I am Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Harlan, Aes Sedai. The Steading offers sanctuary to the servants of the Light.
Thank you, Loyal, son of Arendt, Moraine answered dryly. But I would not be too free with that greeting if I were you. There are perhaps 20 Aes Sedai in Camelin at this moment, and every one but I of the Red Aja.
Loyal nodded sagely, as if he understood. Rand could only shake his head in confusion.
He would be light-blinded if he knew what she meant.
It is strange to find you here, the Aes Sedai went on. Few Ogier leave the Steading in recent years.
The old stories caught me, Aes Sedai. The old books filled my unworthy head with pictures. I want to see the groves, and the cities we built, too. There do not seem to be many of either still standing, but if buildings are a poor substitute for trees, they are still worth seeing. The elders think I'm odd wanting to travel. I always have, and they always have. None of them believe there is anything worth seeing outside the Steading. Perhaps when I return and tell them what I've seen, they will change their minds. I hope so, in time.
Perhaps they will, Moraine said smoothly. Now, Loyal, you must forgive me for being abrupt. It is a failing of humankind, I know. My companions and I have urgent need to plan our journey. If you could excuse us?
It was Loyal's turn to look confused. Rand came to his rescue.
He's coming with us. I promised him he could.
Moraine stood looking at the Ogier, as if she had not heard, but finally she nodded.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, she murmured.
Lan, see that we are not taken unaware.
The warder vanished from the room, silently but for the click of the door shutting behind him. Lan's disappearance acted like a signal. All talk was cut off. Moraine moved to the fireplace, and when she turned back to the room, every eye was on her. Slight of build as she was, her presence dominated.
We cannot remain long in Camelin, nor are we safe here in the Queen's blessing. The Dark One's eyes are already in the city. They have not found what they are searching for, or they would not still be looking. That we have to our advantage. I have set wards to keep them away, and by the time the Dark One realizes that there is a part of the city the rats no longer enter, we will be gone. Any ward that will turn a man aside, though, will be as good as a beacon fire for the Murdral. And there are children of the Light in Camelin, also, looking for Perrin and Egwene.
Rand made a sound, and Moraine raised an eyebrow at him.
I thought they were looking for Matt and me, he said. The explanation made both the Aes Sedai's eyebrows lift.
Why do you think the White Cloaks were looking for you?
I heard one say they were looking for someone from the Two Rivers. Dark friends, he said. What else was I supposed to think, with everything that's been happening? I'm lucky I can think at all.
It has been confusing, I know, Rand, Loyal put in. But you can think more clearly than that. The children hate Aes Sedai. Elida would not.
Elida? Moraine cut in sharply. What has Elida Sedai to do with this? She was looking at Rand so hard that he wanted to lean back.
She wanted to throw me in prison, he said slowly. All I wanted was a look at Loghain, but you wouldn't believe I was in the palace gardens with Elaine and Gawain just by chance.
They were all staring at him, as if he had suddenly sprouted a third eye, all except Loyal.
Queen Morgaze let me go. She said there was no proof I meant any harm, and she was going to uphold the law, no matter what Elida suspected.
He shook his head. the memory of Morgaze in all her radiance making him forget for a minute that anyone was looking at him.
Can you imagine me meeting a queen? She's beautiful, like the queens in stories. So is Elaine. And Gowan? You'd like Gowan, Perrin.
Perrin?
Matt?
They were still staring.
Blood and ashes, I just climbed up on the wall for a look at the false dragon. I didn't do anything wrong.
That's what I always say, Matt said blandly, though he was suddenly grinning hard, and Egwene asked in a decidedly neutral voice,
Who's Elaine?
Moraine muttered something crossly.
A queen,
Perrin said, shaking his head.
You really have had adventures.
All we met were tinkers and some white cloaks. He avoided looking at Moraine so obviously that Rand saw the avoidance plain. Perrin touched the bruises on his face. On the whole, singing with the tinkers was more fun than the white cloaks.
The traveling people live for their songs, Loyal said. For all songs, for that matter. For the search for them, at least. I met some Tuatha'an a few years back, and they wanted to learn the songs we sing to trees. Actually, the trees won't listen to very many anymore, and so not many Ogier learn the songs. I have a scrap of that talent, so Elder Arendt insisted I learn. I taught the Tuatha'an what they could learn, but the trees never listened to humans. For the traveling people, they were only songs, and just as well received for that, since none was the song they seek. That's what they call the leader of each band, the Seeker. They come to Steading Shangtai sometimes. Few humans do.
If you please, Loyal,
Moraine said. But he cleared his throat suddenly and went on in a quick rumble as if afraid she might stop him.
I've just remembered something, Aes Sedai. Something I have always wanted to ask an Aes Sedai if ever I met one. Since you know many things and have great libraries in Tar Valon, and now I have, of course, and may I?
If you make it brief, she said curtly.
Brief,
he said, as though wondering what it meant.
Yes. Well, brief. There was a man came to Steading Shangtai a little time back. This was not unusual in itself at the time, since a great many refugees had come to the spine of the world, fleeing what you humans call the Aiel War.
Rand grinned. A little time back. 20 years, near enough.
He was at the point of death, though there was no wound or mark on him. The elders thought it might be something Aes Sedai had done.
Lael gave Moraine an apologetic look.
Since as soon as he was within the steading, he quickly got well. A few months. One night he left without a word to anyone, simply sneaked away when the moon was down.
He looked at Moraine's face and cleared his throat again.
Yes, brief. Before he left, he told a curious tale which he said he meant to carry to Tar Valon. He said the Dark One intended to blind the eye of the world and slay the great serpent, kill time itself. The elders said he was as sound in his mind as in his body, but that was what he said. What I have wanted to ask is, can the Dark One do such a thing? Kill time itself? And the eye of the world? Can he blind the eye of the great serpent? What does it mean?
Rand expected almost anything from Moraine except what he saw. Instead of giving Loyal an answer or telling him she had no time for it now, she stood there staring right through the Ogier, frowning in thought.
That's what the tinkers told us, Perrin said. Yes, Egwene said. The Aiel story.
Moraine turned her head slowly. No other part of her moved.
What story?
It was an expressionless look she gave them, but it made Perrin take a deep breath, though when he spoke he was as deliberate as ever.
Some tinkers crossing the waste. They said they could do that unharmed. Found Aiel dying after a battle with Trollocs. Before the last Aiel died, she... They were all women, apparently... told the tinkers what Loyal just said.
The Dark One.
They called him Sightblinder. Intends to blind the eye of the world. This was only 3 years ago, not 20. Does it mean something?
Perhaps everything, Moraine said.
Her face was still, but Rand had the feeling her mind raced behind those dark eyes.
Baalzamon,
Perrin said suddenly. The name cut off all sound in the room. No one appeared to breathe. Perrin looked at Rand, then at Matt, his eyes strangely calm and more yellow than ever.
At the time I wondered where I had heard that name before. The Eye of the World. Now I remember. Don't you?
I don't want to remember anything, Matt said stiffly.
We have to tell her, Perrin continued. It's important now. We can't keep it secret any longer. You see it, don't you, Rand?
Tell me what?
Moraine's voice was harsh, and she seemed to be bracing for a blow. Her gaze had settled on Rand. He did not want to answer. He did not want to remember any more than Matt, but he did remember, and he knew Perrin was right. He looked at his friends. Matt nodded reluctantly, Perrin decisively, but at least they had done it. He did not have to face her alone.
We have had dreams.
He rubbed the spot on his finger where the thorn had stuck him once, remembering the blood when he woke. Queasley remembered the sunburned feel of his face another time.
Except maybe they weren't dreams, exactly. Baalzamon was in them.
He knew why Perrin had used that name. It was easier than saying the Dark One had been in your dreams, inside your head.
He said all sorts of things, but once he said the Eye of the World would never serve me.
For a minute, his mouth was as dry as dust.
He told me the same thing, Perrin said,
and Matt sighed heavily, then nodded. Rand found he had spit in his mouth again.
You aren't angry with us?
Perrin asked, sounding surprised, and Rand realized that Moraine did not seem angry. She was studying them, but her eyes were clear and calm, if intent.
More with myself than you, but I did ask you to tell me if you had strange dreams. In the beginning, I asked.
Though her voice remained level, a flash of anger crossed her eyes and was gone in an instant.
Had I known after the first such, I might have been able to... There has not been a dreamwalker in Tarvalen for nearly 1,000 years, but I could have tried. Now it is too late. Each time the Dark One touches you, he makes the next touching easier for him. Perhaps my presence can still shield you somewhat, but even then... Remember the stories of the Forsaken binding men to them? Strong men, men who had fought the Dark One from the start. Those stories are true. And none of the Forsaken had a tenth of the strength of their master. Not Agenor or Lanfear, not Balthamel or Demondred, not even Eshamael, the betrayer of hope himself.
Nynaeve and Egwene were looking at him, Rand saw, him and Matt and Perrin, all three. The women's faces were a blood-drained blend of fear and horror.
Are they afraid for us, or afraid of us? What can we do? He asked. There has to be something. Staying close by me, Moraine replied, will help. Some. The protection from touching the true source extends around me a little, remember? But you cannot always remain close to me. You can defend yourself if you have the strength for it, but you must find the strength and will within yourself. I cannot give it to you.
I think I've already found my protection, Perrin said, sounding resigned rather than happy.
Yes, Moraine said, I suppose you have.
She looked at him until he dropped his eyes, and even then she stood considering. Finally, she turned to the others.
There are limits to the Dark One's power inside you. Yield even for an instant, and he will have a string tied to your heart, a string you may never be able to cut. Surrender, and you will be his. Deny him, and his power fails. It is not easy when he touches your dreams, but it can be done. He can still send half-men against you, and Trollocs, and Dragkar, and other things. But he cannot make you his unless you let him.
Fades are bad enough, Perrin said.
I don't want him inside my head again, Matt growled. Isn't there any way to keep him out?
Moraine shook her head.
Loyal has nothing to fear, nor Egwene, nor Nynaeve. Out of the mass of humanity, the Dark One can touch an individual only by chance, unless that person seeks it. But for a time, at least, you three are central to the pattern. A web of destiny is being woven, and every thread leads straight to you. What else did the Dark One say to you?
I don't remember it all that well, Perrin said. There was something about one of us being chosen, something like that. I remember him laughing, he finished bleakly, about who we were chosen by. He said we could serve him or die, and then we'd still serve him. He said the Amaranthite would try to use us,
Matt added, his voice fading as he remembered to whom he was speaking. He swallowed and went on.
He said just like Tarvalin used, he had some names. Davian, I think. I can't remember very well either.
Raoul and Darksbane, Perrin said.
Yes, Rand said, frowning.
He had tried to forget everything about those dreams. It was unpleasant bringing them back.
Urien Stonebow was another, and Guer Amalasan.
He stopped suddenly, hoping Moraine had not noticed how suddenly.
I don't recognize any of them.
But he had recognized one, now that he dredged them from the depths of memory. The name he had barely stopped himself from saying. Loghain, the false dragon.
Light. Tom said they were dangerous names. Is that what Baal Zemun meant? Moraine wants to use one of us as a false dragon? Aes Sedai hunt down false dragons. They don't use them. Do they? Light, help me, do they?
Moraine was looking at him, but he could not read her face.
Do you know them? He asked her. Do they mean anything?
The Father of Lies is a good name for the Dark One, Moraine replied. It was always his way to seed the worm of doubt wherever he could. It eats at men's minds like a canker. When you believe the Father of Lies, it is the first step toward surrender. Remember, if you surrender to the Dark One, he will make you his. An Aes Sedai never lies, but the truth she speaks may not be the truth you think you hear.
That was what Tam had said, and she had not really answered his question. He kept his face expressionless and held his hands still on his knees, trying not to scrub the sweat off them on his breeches. Egwene was crying softly. Nynaeve had her arms around her, but she looked as if she wanted to cry too. Rand almost wished he could.
They are all Ta'veren, Loyal said abruptly.
He seemed brightened by the prospect, looking forward to watching from close by as the pattern wove itself around them. Rand looked at him incredulously, and the Ogier gave an abashed shrug, but it was not enough to dim his eagerness.
So they are, Moraine said. Three of them, when I expected one. A great many things have happened that I did not expect. This news concerning the Eye of the World changes much.
She paused, frowning.
For a time the pattern does seem to be swirling around all three of you, just as Loyal says, and the swirl will grow greater before it becomes less. Sometimes being Ta'veren means the pattern is forced to bend to you, and sometimes it means the pattern forces you to the needed path. The web can still be woven many ways, and some of those designs would be disastrous. For you, for the world. We cannot remain in Camelin, but by any road, Myrdral and Trolloc will be on us before we have gone 10 miles. And just at this point, we hear of a threat to the Eye of the World. Not from one source, but three, each seeming independent of the others. The pattern is forcing our path. The pattern still weaves itself around you three, but what hand now sets the warp, and what hand controls the shuttle? Has the Dark One's prison weakened enough for him to exert that much control?
There's no need for that kind of talk, Nynaeve said sharply. You'll only frighten them.
But not you, Moraine asked. It frightens me.
Well, perhaps you are right. Fear cannot be allowed to affect our course. Whether this is a trap or a timely warning, we must do what we must, and that is to reach the eye of the world quickly. The Green Man must know of this threat.
Rand gave a start.
The Green Man? The others stared too, all but Loyal, whose broad face looked worried. I cannot even risk stopping in Tarvalin for help, Moraine continued. Time traps us. Even if we could ride out of the city unhindered, it would take many weeks to reach the Blight, and I fear we no longer have weeks.
The Blight! Rand heard himself echoed in a chorus, but Moraine ignored them all.
The pattern presents a crisis and at the same time a way to surmount it. If I did not know it was impossible, I could almost believe the Creator is taking a hand. There is a way. She smiled as if at a private joke and turned to Loyal. There was an Ogier grove here at Camelin, and a waygate. The new city now spreads out over where the grove once stood, so the waygate must be inside the walls. I know not many Ogier learn the ways now, but one who has a talent and learns the old songs of growing must be drawn to such knowledge, even if he believes it will never be used. Do you know the ways, Loyal?
The Ogier shifted his feet uneasily.
I do, Aes Sedai, but...
Can you find the path to Fal'Dara along the ways?
I've never heard of Fal'Dara, Loyal said, sounding relieved.
In the days of the Trolloc Wars, it was known as Mafal de Daranel. Do you know that name?
I know it, Loyal said reluctantly. But...
Then you can find the path for us, Moraine said. A curious turn indeed. When we can neither stay nor leave by any ordinary means, I learn of a threat to the eye, and in the same place there is one who can take us there in days. Whether it is the Creator or fate, or even the Dark One, the pattern has chosen our path for us.
No,
Loyal said, an emphatic rumble like thunder. Everyone turned to look at him, and he blinked under the attention, but there was nothing hesitant about his words.
If we enter the ways, we will all die, or be swallowed by the shadow.
Chapter 43 Decisions and Apparitions. The Aes Sedai appeared to know what Loyal meant, but she said nothing. Loyal peered at the floor, rubbing under his nose with a thick finger as if he was abashed by his outburst. No one wanted to speak.
Why? Rand asked at last. Why would we die? What are the ways?
Loyal glanced at Moraine. She turned away to take a chair in front of the fireplace. The little cat stretched, its claws scratching on the hearthstone, and languidly walked over to butt its head against her ankles. She rubbed behind its ears with one finger. The cat's purring was a strange counterpoint to the Aes Sedai's level voice.
It is your knowledge, Loyal. The ways are the only path to safety for us. The only path to forestalling the Dark One, if only for a time. But the telling is yours.
The Ogier did not appear comforted by her speech.